Welcome, folks. We are live. Jack Spirico here today. A special show with a co-host. I'm going to consider instead of a guest, Guy Swan. And if you're on Guy's channel, he's here simulcasting with me. Guy, welcome to the Survival Podcast, man.
What's up, man? Good to be back.
I'm glad we got to do this. I think the last time we got together was about 6 months ago, and it got cut short because of a vet thing or whatever that was going on.
Yeah,
here.
So yeah,
now we can just riff now. I got the man, the legend himself, Guy, with me today. This is going to be cool. So for maybe the people that are maybe new to the Bitcoin, I think if you're in the Bitcoin space for any time, you probably know who Guy Swan is. But maybe for some folks that don't because they're new, who is Guy Swan and what's his deal?
Who is Guy Swan and what's his deal? Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. Well, I have been in Bitcoin for, so I have a background in film and then went kind of the technical route. I've always been like super, super nerdy, whether it was engineering or building stuff or whatever as a, while I was younger. And then like, I just loved story and I loved ideas. And so that took me down the film route. And so I did that in school, and then film has no money in it. It's just a passion project that makes you do bitch work if you live in LA. And so I left there. I was like, this isn't fitting. Went back into tech. And at some point in that mix, as I was discovering libertarianism, as I was going down this fascinating rabbit hole on internet history and discovering the cypherpunks and rediscovering BitTorrent as not this tool that not this toy, basically, that I thought it was when I was younger, just where I could get music and movies, you know, but like something that fundamentally changed the market. Like it broke the model, like a business model around the whole world. And that was like, oh my God, this was actually huge. And I didn't see it from that perspective. So I was rediscovering these things, and my brother was doing economics in college, and we were living together. And so he would come back and we would go down the economics rabbit hole, and we would argue about the stupid Keynesian crap that his college taught him. And so like all of these things, and we're discovering Austrian economics at the same time. So we had this confluence of so many different ideas, and we found Bitcoin. It just got mentioned to him in a conversation online, and we found it back in 2011. And we were down the rabbit hole, like immediately, just utterly fascinated. It was literally everything that I was interested in and at the time built into one system and project, and made it through a couple of very vicious and awful bear market eras of Bitcoin. And then in 2017, when the altcoin bubble happened and all this occurred, and then we were down on the bear market side again. I had been thinking about making a podcast or doing something, being present in the Bitcoin space, you know? And I realized that I had sat on that for like 2 to 3 years and done nothing with it. And so after the 2017, after it popped and we were back down, I was like, I just let this whole thing happen again. And I felt like I was still not a part of it. You know, like I was just lurking. And so I started a podcast, started What Is Bitcoin Audible Today? And I read articles, research papers, cypherpunk history, Austrian economics pieces, like you name it. If it's related to Bitcoin, I've covered it on the show. And it started to grow from there. You know, first episode was just me reading into my iPhone and like 12 people listened to it. And I was like, what? Okay. And then I did it again the next day. And, you know, 1400 episodes later, 6 years now, it's been a huge success. I don't know. It's done great. I love it. I love digging into the ideas. I love talking with people in the space and staying up on everything. And I am the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else, you know. Done audiobooks, like 20, I don't even know. Like,
I counted today. I think I got 23.
And 23,
I think 23 is what was on Amazon that I tracked with your name. Mm-hmm. And I think I rounded it to 24 in the show notes because 23 something. So you got to go through another.
23 is a bad number. I got to like jack it up.
Yeah, you got to jack it up. 21's a good number. After that,
I got a couple more on the way. I got a couple more on the way. So.
You need even numbers or fives and zeros. Mm-hmm. Like that's how all things should end. It sucks. You're acting on episode 3599 of the Survival Podcast today. You missed a round number by one episode.
By one. Everything.
Yeah, 3600.
You have to bring me back for 4K.
Yeah. Oh,
10K. When we're up to 10K.
I agree. 10K. We're going to want to be dead by then, but yeah. if the idiots in the Department of Defense and the Deep State have their way, we might all go up in a blinding flash of light. On better topics, though, you and I were just riffing a little bit before I brought you on. What is being in the space now for over 10 years taught you about people's inability to accept something that's right in front of them? Like we were just talking about how we're hearing the same crap. We're hearing quantum computing is going to break Bitcoin. Like where have we heard that before? Right. We're hearing stuff like it's a tulip. I just heard tulip bulbs again. And as you said,
it is remarkable how little people understand the history of tulip bulbs. They have no idea how any of that happened. Like
I tried planting my Bitcoins in the ground to grow more of them. It didn't work. But kind of a really astute thing you said, and I guess I knew this. I just didn't really think about it this way. It's one thing when these new people show up and they repeat these old lies. But there are people that have literally
they don't know. They haven't heard the argument against it, right?
Anybody a pass on not knowing because you weren't here. To a degree anyway, because then you shouldn't talk so much. But what I'm talking about are the people like that we've watched 10, 12 years now say the same stupid shit and be proven wrong, and they still keep saying it. What do you think causes the human mind to reject the thing that's right there that's working for everybody else?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's uncomfortable. Particularly depending on how deep seated an idea is to address it. Like I know, like as a, growing up as a flag waving Republican, you know, kind of like America's freedom sort of thing. And in that culture, I remember like how difficult it was for me to accept. And I had to literally have multiple different threads in completely different categories or disciplines, I guess, reinforce that, like areas in which I was happy to go down the rabbit hole because it didn't appear to be challenging that idea. But like and I think that was a big part of my realization that, you know, the American government was not the good guy, you know, that we've done horrible, horrible things, that it is the whole system. The whole structure of it for a very long time has been super corrupt. I mean, and that's with the fact that America still has been largely the most free nation on earth, but just what the government has, like I thought, you know, the world wars and the Great Depression, you know, that the government saved us from this thing. You know, I believed all the, it just seemed like you're the history story that you are told in school is just that the good guys always win. And then when you actually learn the history, you're like, none of you bitches are good guys. Like all of you, you all did horrible, horrible things. And there was no reason for any of this to even happen. Like you caused this, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a very difficult realization. I remember the moment actually, when I was kind of felt lost because I had been like this patriot and there was this part of my identity that was like flag waving, you know, and I thought I lost that. And then I remember it was a Benjamin Franklin quote that hit me because I had equated freedom with the idea of American, like the idea of like the government and this nation. And then Benjamin Franklin had a quote that said, "Where freedom reigns, there is my country." And it just made me realize that I had just equated two things in my mind that weren't. And I could still be and hold all the values that I'd always held. It's just not connected to what I thought it was. And in that same way, in a very similar way, I think when you start to identify with an idea, it becomes extremely difficult to You just want to believe that everybody else is stupid if your model of the world doesn't play out. And then there's this level of like belligerence and like digging in your heels that if you go through two cycles, three cycles of this, and it still, it exponentially continues to negate your model. You just want to believe, like I literally hear people say, it's like, well, maybe Bitcoin, I literally have heard people capitulate in the not too distant or in the recent past with this framing that like, okay, stupid is just going to win. I guess I should get some. And I'm just like, maybe your model isn't right. You know, like maybe you just have a model that is not correct. If it continues to just not map reality at all, like if you had a map of the world and you kept, and it, you know, the coast, you're going up the coast and it says that this part of the coast is flat. And then every single time you definitely have to turn the sail and you have to go around. Like at some point after you do that five times, don't you think maybe the map is wrong? Like all of our mental models are just maps. If the world does not line up, if what is happening is exponentially defying your model, maybe consider your model is broken. And that doesn't mean you're stupid. You don't have to take it personally. Everybody's models are broken. All models are broken. Models are useful in, you know, painting basically a finger painting picture of the world. It can never be completely accurate. All we have are dumb, like monkey brain, like simplifications of what's really happening in the world. So like, get over it. You were wrong. Like now just add, like maybe you can learn something. I don't know.
I think part of it's just psychology and, you know, getting out of the Bitcoin space to explain things about Bitcoin is a good idea because analogies let people let go of things. So I'm sure you've heard of the boiling frog analogy, right? You put the frog in the water and you turn the heat up real slow and the frog just sits there and dies. Well, go and tell somebody that doesn't work that way. And watch how triggered they get, very angry, right? Well, it doesn't make any sense that it would work that way. Like somebody thought it up that probably wasn't even trying to say it was real. And then it got repeated enough. And when things are repeated enough and moreover, when people repeat them themselves, which is part of, to me, I believe the programming of statism, religion, et cetera, get people to repeat things long enough. It's not so, remember, was it Goebbels or one of the Nazis said, if you tell a lie loud enough and long enough, people will believe it. But the real power is in getting them to say it themselves, like mass save lies, right? You get them to do that long enough and then they'll get violently angry at, you know, they got violently angry at me because I was in the middle of the wilderness fishing without a mask on, literally like 10 miles from a road. And I did this little, I had to get enough signal I could do a little live video. And I had people screaming at me in the middle of COVID. I was killing people because I was daring to be out in the wilderness without a mask. There's not even another human here, even though it doesn't, regardless, it just doesn't make any sense. And I think that there is a point where people have said something, or if something they really, someone they really admire has said it many times, it becomes like gospel. Thou shalt not change it. And I think in this space, you're doing this at your own peril. I think we get a lot of heat from people for saying things like have fun staying poor or whatever, but you know, we don't just walk around saying that. That's pretty much after you've tried to help somebody like 20 times and you're like, fuck it. Like, what else do you want me to do? Because I've given you the facts, I've given you the theory, and you've given me nothing but emotion, and I'm done now.
And it's also funny about have fun staying poor.
Yeah.
It's not wishing poverty on people.
No.
It's not saying you suck, I hope you end up poor.
No.
It's saying that you're defending the thing that is making you poor right now. I guess if you want to do that, have fun staying poor. You know, it's like it's just like I'm just going to throw my hands up because I don't know what else to do. I'm trying to tell you something that's going to help, you know?
And what I've tried to say, and it sounds arrogant, but I don't mean it to, but all you've done, and I'm talking to my own audience here, all you've done by ignoring my advice for the past 12, almost 13 years now, is guarantee that you're not a millionaire today. Because if you would have took my advice, you would be. Honestly, if I would have taken the advice I'm giving today, if I would have known that advice when I started, I'd probably be like, hi, folks, we're coming from Jackistan today, right? I mean, if I just had back all the Bitcoins that I spent in the beginning. But in the beginning, there was a very big movement to spend it. If you didn't spend it, it wouldn't work. If you didn't spend it, it wouldn't become what it could become. It was a payment system. And this led to all the shit coining with it's faster, cheaper, more transactions per second. I'm interested in what your thought is on this. I contend the main reason that Bitcoin is not used enough as a payment system today to pacify people's desire for that has nothing to do with how slow it is, how expensive it is, the code, any of that shit. It's tax treatment. If you're running a major business and you need to receive revenue, convert, and then go back out to spend revenue to cover expenses, this is an accounting pain in the ass. Unless you completely automate it, and then you're still driving down your revenue in some ways because of these additional steps and conversion costs. Because let's say I take Bitcoin all this week, and I, you know, I'm a company. I'm not Bill selling, you know, plums and ammo out of my backyard. I am doing business above board because I don't want the Department of SAT to come seize my assets and, you know, destroy my shareholders' value and all that. Mm-hmm. It is a mess to do this. And I think that that's like the one thing government's actually been able to do to really hinder it. And the brilliance of it is that nobody talks about it. Like the only person I even hear talk about is a guy that I'm in and out on at times is Saylor. Michael Saylor is the only person I've ever really heard talk about that.
Yeah. In fact, I should do, and let me write that down. I should do an episode on exactly that. I think it's one of three things. So I think taxes are a big part of it.
Yep.
I think another huge part of it is that the system itself, like money, like fundamentally is not a payment network. Like every money we've ever had in history, the money itself, like what defines it as a money is separate from the payment network. Like even the dollar, like none of the payment networks we use are actually interacting with the system that defines the dollar. They're just layers. They're just services on top. Payments is a service. Like networks of communications are literally just networks of communications. The interesting thing about Bitcoin is that these are a little bit conflated because you have to have transactional rules to define transactions in order to define transactional rules for ownership. But really what Bitcoin is a defined digital asset and a system of rules for ownership. So it's, and you look at like how it's designed, it is terribly designed when it comes to a retail, like consumer level payments network. It's a bidding war. It is an open market bidding war. Like you don't even know when you're going to get into the next block. Like everybody just throws out random fees in this giant, it looks a whole lot more like a decentralized stock market for getting confirmations, like an auction. Than it does a retail payments network. You don't want to be like confused as to whether or not your payment's going to happen after you swipe a card. Like that's not a retail environment, you know? And if like a whole bunch of other people are swiping your card, did you have to like wait in line? You know, like it's about consensus. So it doesn't help that the technology is built around consensus and integrity and ownership rule, like a system of secure ownership. But then the third one, it's just flat Gresham's law. Mm. It's the simplest, most like fundamental economics principle about money that we know is that if you have really good money, if you have really strong money in a really loose money, a very soft money environment, well, then people are going to store. They're going to try to get the good money as much as they can and store it away. And they're going to spend the crap money. That's literally that is Gresham's law 101. That is the definition of Gresham's law. And this is exactly what we see play out. This was not even slightly unexpected. If you just think about monetary history and how things monetize, look at every monetary competition that has ever occurred. When a new money comes in, a harder money comes into an environment, what happens to it? How does it react? Like, and we're supposed to like prescribe that people are supposed to do something with it. Well, why don't you just look at history and see how this happens? This continues until the loose money gets so undesirable that people just start demanding good money. And if the government can artificially keep up the, in the exact same way, like in black markets and stuff, the government can artificially keep up the demand for bad money. I mean, that's why we've had bad money in governments all across the world, and why you have black market prices that are, you know, 10x the official price for currencies all over the world as they begin to collapse. But it has nothing to do with the thing is that if you have a lie about what the prices of those things are, that means it ends up being more valuable as just that. Gresham's law is just determining what the highest value use case is for it at the time. And right now, arbitrarily spending it for no reason when everybody accepts dollars and dollars are losing value and Bitcoin is gaining value, you save the Bitcoin and you spend the dollars. And there's a huge infrastructure problem too. It's like saying, why doesn't everybody drive around in electric cars back when there's still no place to charge your freaking electric car if you go out, when the gas stations still have gas? It's a circular problem. If you can't spend it at places and people actually have to change their infrastructure, they have to install new software and understand a new thing. And there's these three other major resistances. The fact that the fundamental thing isn't really well designed as a payment network, that you have a tax burden, and Gresham's law is your scream fighting against the current as hard as you can go because Gresham's law wants you to just hold on to it. Well, then, yeah, of course. Of course. I don't know. It was always so freaking obvious that this would be how it I don't know. Like, monetary history is not confusing about this. You know,
no.
This is literally how it happens.
I think there's a lot of people. And by the way, before we progress on with this, I happen to have run a poll last week on this. And I gave three choices: high fees and slow transaction times. 9% of 10% of people basically said that's the problem. 39% said number go up, which is Gresham's law, and that's where I want to hit on next. And 50% roughly say it's an accounting nightmare. And I think that your take on that will have a lot to do with who you are. If you run a business, especially one with hard costs against it, like if I double my membership next year, my cost barely rises because I'm selling a soft product.
Yeah.
But when I was in a business where I was sending a contractor out to do work and I had to bill the customer, take the differential and pay the contractor, I've got to move money. I can't just say, oh, this particular bucket of money's long term. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I've got to have cash flow in and out. That's going to angle you more toward the cash flow issue and the tax treatment. When it comes to, and by the way, you know, you're talking about infrastructure. It's not just payment infrastructure, it's accounting infrastructure. Every piece of accounting software in the country that every major company is using is denominated in dollars. Yeah. And everything is set up and designed. All the formulas are built around dollars. And it's perceived stability. It's not stable. It's this, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it is. But it's perceived stability because what you take in as a dollar today, whether it's worth more or less, is still a dollar tomorrow. Where Bitcoin, it will change, right? For the better or the worse. But the Gresham's Law thing, if you're my age or older, and you're probably just a little too young to really remember when this was a thing, you went to the store, you bought something, they handed you a handful of change back, and the first thing you did was shake it. And if there were silver coins in there, it sounded different. And as soon as you knew that, you picked them out. Right? You didn't have to even look at the side. You could tell by the sound, like jingle, and you heard like that certain different tink, and you're like, oh, there's a silver quarter or a dime in there. And so if you had the experience of actually being an active part of a demonetized monetary unit and seizing that unit and removing it and not spending it, when somebody says you have to spend Bitcoin today, you're like, yeah, but I'm not gonna. Right? I'm just not gonna because this is, I look at this as we take two words and we throw them together all the time. And I think in this space, the crypto bros have made it worse by cryptocurrency. We take currency and money as though they're the same. To me, they're really not. A currency is something anybody can create. Governments are really good at creating currencies, just not managing them. Mm-hmm. But money is something that the market will select as money regardless of what government says. The market doesn't give a shit. Like, I know the best value, the best place to store my wealth is here, and money is for storing wealth. It can be a means of payment, but if you have a low value currency sitting next to a hard quality money, people will spend all the currency before they spend a fraction of the money because you're dumb. I'm sorry about all these people that really want this to be what Satoshi wanted. And we'll get to that in a bit. I got some things I want to talk to you about that with, Because that is the shit coiners creed, man, especially certain shit coiners, right? But what Satoshi wanted, but what Satoshi coded was consensus. That's the way you know what somebody wants.
That's the revolution of the system, and people just don't get like a phenomenal, like that is incredibly profound thing that we don't have anywhere else, that literally cannot be replicated, and that this is not important because, you know, it's supposed to, and especially when they talk about like, oh, they used to accept it with like BitPay. Nobody accepted Bitcoin, man. Mm-hmm. They accepted dollars through a system because they thought they could get more people to buy. They thought they could get new customers that was in this new market.
I called it orange washing at the time, right? It was orange washing.
Yeah. They took Bitcoin and they turned it into dollars. It is no different from me paying a company that sells gift cards for dollars and then spending those dollars. The only difference, the only way that it will actually ever become a medium of exchange, it is axiomatically necessary that you go store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account, because they are dependent on the liquidity of the previous era in order to actually function. You will never, the only way we get to medium of exchange with Bitcoin is after we get to a place where everyone wants to hold Bitcoin.
You have to choke out the old.
You have to accept it. Yeah. Everyone has to accept actual Bitcoin directly, and they have to want to hold it more than its alternatives. That's it. Then it can become a medium of exchange. We're just starting into the medium of exchange era. And I really think the core place in which you can actually see it is Noster, because you can actually do something novel with it, and it changes the experience in a completely new way, because you can just zap each other and value for value. Just like, you know, you posted the thing, or you said in the email that you do 20% value for value. That's so cool. That is so freaking cool that you can do that in an environment, and that's where it will shine. That's where all the culture and, you know, slang terms will be defined. That's where it will be used as a medium of exchange. And then that will expand when people realize that there's this whole world with these new capabilities and new things that you can do, and they'll go and check it out.
Yeah. That just reminded me too. I need to cut you in for a share of boosts on Fountain today. Right. Because
I saw your old one, because when you had Brian Harrington on with me, I was reading that email. I was like, wait a second, I'm reading the totally wrong email or whatever. So I was like trying to find it.
But that's what I'll do. Since Brian's not here with us, I'll split mine with you evenly, and Tom gets his piece for running everything. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we can do that, and it's not a lot of money, but it's frictionless. Yeah. And so I think Lightning is the future, despite all the FUD that says it's not. I also think there's a high probability that there'll be some sort of a bridge that'll look like Bitcoin's money, dollars are currency, but there's probably going to be a lot of payments that are dollars going across Lightning or some other Bitcoin network. Mm-hmm. I think that is a real high probability. And people say, well, you can do it faster, whatever, blah, with Solana or some crap. But if we're talking about money, what do we want? Man. We want security above everything else, right? Security is
integrity and liquidity. Those are the only things that matter when it comes to money. Those are the only things. Solana doesn't have shit. Like, they've got neither one of those things.
Like, and you know more about shitcoins than I do at this point, because I've so tuned out. I don't even know. I know. And I'll admit to anybody that's tuning in, maybe doesn't know my history, I was a shitcoiner for a while. I was always what I called a shitcoin minimalist. I was never like jumping shitcoin to shitcoin.
I went through that phase. We all did.
Yeah. I looked at things like when it first came out, Algorand, and I'm like, you know, with NFTs, if we weren't making pick JPEGs, if we were actually using it like as a title to a good, you know, or if we wanted if we wanted a public ledger that was also secure, that a lower tech blockchain or a different type of blockchain might be good for that. So, for instance, you want people to be able to look up who owns the title to a property. Mm-hmm. But you also want that to be incredibly secure. You don't want somebody changing that information. So if you could tokenize that, and then I realized, like, so this is never going to happen. And if it does, it'll be built on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Like, those two things kind of came together, and I was done. And when I started seeing app builders not just integrate Bitcoin, but actually build on top of it, then it was like, okay, then all this other shit that's supposed to do all this stuff, and no one's doing it. If you remember when Bitcoin Cash, which I call Bitcoin Trash, came out, the only interesting thing in that to me was SLP. And for those that don't know, that's Simple Ledger Protocol. And it was all about these micro payments and split payments. And it's everything that you can do on LN today. Mm-hmm. And you still can't do it with freaking Bitcoin Trash. You can't. Yeah. It's not there because, and it's not because it's not doable. It's because nobody did it. Because nobody thought it was worth doing. And I think that's kind of an roundabout what we're talking about here. Like, you're only going to, if you're going to have Gresham's Law be a thing, you're going to only have one best money. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the investment that somebody's going to make in building on top of something is going to go to the best. And just because two guys in a, and I don't want to pick on two guys in a garage because friggin' Mallers built Strike in a closet or some shit, right? Yeah. But in the end, companies that are really going to make an investment of time and money in talent into building something on top of a payment network, why would you pick anything subpar? Because you think that one day it might be worth more money? That's not how people build technology on top of a thing. That's a gambling or trader mindset.
Mm-hmm. And it's also important to remember that, like, the monetary premium, the entire value of the payment, is built around the integrity of the value of the asset you're exchanging. Like, you can't just, like I could build a Visa competitor that could just, like, make payments so much better.
Yeah.
But if I then only made it available in Venezuelan bolivars or, you know, bags of dog poo or something, like, it would not make the Venezuelan bolivars more valuable. It would not make the dog crap more valuable. It would make people go, oh, well, I'm going to buy more Venezuelan bolivars and I'll, you know, fill my trunk full of dog crap because the value of this is going to explode because of this brilliant payment network. The payment network has no value if your asset is not desirable. Like, this is not, you cannot have this, like, I'm just going to build all of this stuff on top of it. And if none of the assurances of the underlying, those things don't matter because its value is in the quote unquote utility of payments. Money is its own utility. Money is its own utility because where on earth do you hold value in something that can hold enormous amounts of value that has no counterparty risk, that has nobody in charge, that has nobody that can rug pull you? You do not understand. That is a $100 trillion problem. That is the biggest problem on earth. How do you achieve consensus and how do you hold value? Achieve consensus in an environment in which nobody can agree on anything in which mm-hmm. they argue about the stupidest little thing. Bitcoiners argue internally about the most, where there's an argument on Twitter right now about whether we should move sats to Bitcoins.
Oh, that's
it's so stupid.
Thing,
we argue
bro.
About everything. Oh, everything.
So stupid.
Disagreements are infinite.
Yeah.
The idea is, how can you defend a system such that those disagreements do not inhibit the operation of a fundamental system, of the economic system? Because when you make that money political, you do. The politics destroys the integrity of the entire system. So how do you hold value without counterparty risk? You have to do something where no matter how many times people are fudding about it, no matter how many times people are screaming at each other and arguing about the direction that it's going to go and which software they're going to download and whether or not it's supposed to be valuable or whether it's hot air, that it remains the same thing, that it is still 21 million, that those ownership rules are not changed. And that is the biggest problem on earth. Because humans suck at agreeing. They suck really, really bad. And if they have any amount of power, they will change something. They will use it to influence and manipulate.
I think
that is why Bitcoin is so powerful.
I think one of the things people can do, and I hesitate to say this because I really don't want more people doing it, to understand mm-hmm. this, though, is to run for office. Mm-hmm. I ran for office back in the mid-early 2000s. And I started finding myself thinking differently, even though I had no intention of winning. I ran as a libertarian. I didn't expect to win. But mm-hmm. I started thinking, well, I better not say that, right? Or I better not do that. Or I better not be seen saying that or doing that. And then I was talking about this to somebody at a work function, and our attorney, who we had a retainer there, this dude named Jeff. And it was almost like I felt like I was in a movie where the devil's making you a deal. he walks up to me, he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he goes, I know who has that seat down there in Arlington. Do you want that seat? We can make that happen. And there was no hesitation. There was no pause. There was no nothing. This man was like, I will make a phone call to another person. We'll start doing some fundraising. And if you want that house seat, you can have that house seat. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. But once you experience that, then you start to realize how your mind is so easily manipulated by desires and certain things. And that's why somebody wants to go ape shit on shitcoin XYZ, even though it doesn't seem connected, but it's, I'm too late for Bitcoin. But this story I heard about this guy named Swan, right? Like, he bought Bitcoin, was really cheap, man, and now he's rich. And it's too late for me to do that with Bitcoin, but this other one, it's only a quarter, man. It can't go lower than
Farcoin
that.
Farcoin is so, Farcoin's right at the beginning. The S curve's about to happen. Farcoin's it, man.
But shouldn't you be looking, and then people turn around and say shit like, you know, gold this, or this has been around forever, or this is, you know, the most trustworthy thing. And like, the thing you should probably look at is like, over the last decade, what is the monetary asset that has been most viciously attacked by the most entities and has not given a fuck? And there's only one answer to that question. There is nothing that has been hammered as hard and yet stood as tall as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Does not care.
And you can try to say Ethereum, because I'll give the Ether bros a little bit that, like, if you price Bitcoin and Ether, it doesn't look so good over the last 2 years. But overall, it's kind of hung better than anything else has. But it hasn't been attacked.
Yeah.
Right. It hasn't been in the crosshairs because it's not the enemy. Right. Nobody's afraid of it. You want the one that they're afraid of. They attack it and it still kills them back. That's what you're looking for. Or, you know, like the superhero that takes your power when you attack him with your superpower. Just, that's the scariest fucker, right? Like, you use your laser beams, and he's just like, now I have laser beams.
Yeah, like, I posted something along in line with that, actually, not too long ago, is that Bitcoin was destined to be the most hated and the most lied about and the most, like, viciously attacked, specifically because it will not give anybody what they want.
I saw that.
Now everybody's got, like, their vision about it, and it's got to change to do this thing. And you literally have to just accept it as it is. And if you want to change it, you have to change it within consensus. Because the simple, like, it's, oh my God, it's so funny to have people who, people who were on the side that lost the block size wars. Because
let's pick that scab. Consensus was
too strong.
Let's go and pick that scab, because I want to. With our mutual non-friend. Roger, right? So Roger just did this interview with Tucker. He tells this entire story of how the government's going after him because of his book. But the government was going after him before his book because by the letter of the law, he committed tax fraud. Now, I'm going to be the first person to say I think all tax is theft. And I don't want to, even though I don't like
it. I think he did the right thing. I think he did the right thing. And I also, I think you have a moral obligation. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you have a moral obligation to not fund, to do anything that you can to fund as little mass murder as possible. And the government does nothing but destroy wealth. I mean, just staggering level.
But but his book and the block wars are not why the federal government is prosecuting him for tax.
No, it's just not.
No. And so I want to just clear the air that I'm not advocating Roger Ver in jail for 109 years. I don't believe that's okay.
Even if he had committed the worst tax fraud ever and he actually owed like $100 million.
Then take the money.
The idea of 109 years, that's that's so insane. That is so insane. Like, rapists get like 4 years.
Yeah.
Like, Roger didn't hurt anybody.
People that shoot people get 5 years or less.
I just cannot believe it.
There are legit murderers who walk from prison, you know, after 20, 25 years or something like that. So that's bullshit. But his story is bullshit. And the one that I think is the most bullshit, and I'm waiting for anybody to counter this scenario for me. His whole argument hinges mostly on the fact that he was kicked off a subreddit, as though one subreddit had complete control over all of Bitcoin. You and you're a technical guy, and I'm a sort of technical guy, so I have a Bitcoin node I've been running forever. You probably have one or more, and you were probably running a node during the block wars.
Mm-hmm.
and you probably didn't pick up the new code. You kept running core. Okay. Mm-hmm. I have not yet found a person. I'd love to talk to them if they exist. It's like, man, if I had just read one more post on Reddit, then I would have went with the bigger blocks. Like this whole idea that by being thrown out of a private forum, you've altered the path of Bitcoin. I don't even, can you explain this logic in any way, guy? Because I don't get it.
Man. Actually, frame that again.
How can you, with a straight face, make this argument that if Roger Ver had been allowed to stay in a subreddit, that everything would have turned out differently? Like, because I don't know anybody. Because here's one of the things I think, there's so many people on the outside, and there's a lot of people, to be fair to them, they come to this late. They weren't here when this all happened. Yeah. He's a good storyteller, and he's a good libertarian. I'll give him two compliments on that. So when he puts that together that way, if you don't know any better, you would tend to believe it. But consensus on the network for the base code that you're running comes from little boxes all over the world, thousands and thousands of them. And right when this all happened, I remember he tweeted, he said, don't like the code, don't run it. And my response is, we didn't, so we didn't.
Yeah, so that's what happened. It just didn't turn out like you wanted. It just did not turn out like you wanted.
So it must be a conspiracy. Somebody did Blockstream, beamed him up to the alien ship, and then they probed his ass, and then they made the block small again or something. I mean, this is – and then the other thing people, I think, don't realize, like, because I know you were here for this. You remember him telling us publicly what he was about to do. I'm going to sell all my Bitcoin. I'm going to drive the price down. Bitcoin Cash is the way forward. Can you handle it? Is what he said. You think you can handle it? Because he was bankrolled with lots of Bitcoin, which he still has plenty of Bitcoin, by the way. But he did then just start selling, trying to drive the price down. And most of us were like, oh, look, cheap sats. We bought it all the way down and all the way back up. But like, how is there any way that you can give any credibility to that version? Because I can't. And I have lots of people, some I really respect, telling me I'm wrong. And when I get that, when it's people that I don't know or don't care about, okay. Most people I respect in other walks of life, I try to do some self-examination, and I got nothing here.
There's two big problems. One is the view of the Bitcoin model. Like the Bitcoin model in your mind, like how and why it works the way it works, requires you to understand that it is not the social model that we usually have for how things work. And most people are still fully embraced or fully trapped in the whole, he said, she said, this is what people thought, and therefore this, like the social model is why a thing went one way or another. And so they are terribly prone to misunderstanding how the dynamics of the network inhibit the social layer from changing, like, or basically fight against, causing a massive amount of resistance for the social layer, because the social layer is so bad at consensus and the protocol layer is great at it. And that conflict makes it seem like Steve Patterson, when we were on the show with Clint together just the other day, he kept talking about we had consensus, all this stuff. And he's literally pointing to like a handful of companies and a handful of mining pools and saying that this was consensus. And then he's also talking about like a bunch of the core devs all thought it was a good idea to have a block size increase. And I'm like, and nobody agreed on which one. Nobody agreed on which one. That's not consensus. Consensus on the fact that, like, okay, yeah, maybe we should do this, but then how should you do this? Like, there's a very explicit, concrete thing that has to happen. The whole problem was that nobody could ever agree on how, to what degree. There was no shelling point outside of the protocol to fall on. It wasn't that we didn't have any ideas and we didn't want to change or improve Bitcoin continuously going forward. It was literally about how. Like, your idea that there was consensus was literally the thing that we were having trouble. We had no consensus on. And then he just points to the social layer. It would be like me saying that, like, well, all the big podcasters agree on this, and therefore we have consensus. You think Bitcoin is defined by like the top 10 podcasters? Like, it just, thank God it's not.
You tell me if I'm wrong. I think some of the biggest mouths about this never ran a note in their life. Therefore, they didn't participate in the quote unquote election, right? Like people, I think it's a stupid argument. People say in like political elections, if you don't vote, you can't pitch. Well, you know, a node on the Bitcoin network has more say than a voter in America.
Mm-hmm.
Just on math, just on what percentage of the whole is it? And so these people haven't
by orders of magnitude.
They haven't even begun to actually make a contribution to the thing that they say is so precious to them. Mm-hmm. And to me, like I said, it's back to it doesn't. And my other thought is, so this is why I did it personally. Well, I just said, like, I don't even care. I'm sticking with what we have. When I looked at all the proposals, I was like, but we have something that does that already. But we have something that does that already. But we have something that does that already. Like, everybody's like, yeah, like, well, this thing already does the thing that you say we need to do. And it's not even close to challenging us for dominance. Mm-hmm. So why would I switch to a thing that's already failing? Because I think I need to. And what it reminded me is back when I had marketing clients, I might go into a client and say something like, here's a plan for you. I think what we need to do is take this technology thing that you're working on and we need to do a press release with a white paper on the other side, do old school information capture. They don't want to do it. 6 months later, you get a phone call from your client who's irate. You haven't done any press releases because their competitor just did a press release. Right. And it's like, since I saw somebody else do it, now I have to do it. Even though when I brought it to you, you didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
At least mine was a good idea.
Man, one of the other things that gets me about the whole, especially with the Rogers version of the narrative, is the sheer amount, like, you know, you can make your argument without just changing the order of operations, like without just complete revisionist history, you know, and he does not do that. That's one of the things that bugs the ever loving hell out of me. He just tells it the way it's useful to him, and that's it. And it's one of the things that inclines me, even against my better judgment, to not even want to feel sorry for him. Like, he's put himself in so many bad situations. He has caused so much confusion and literally been super manipulative about stuff. Like, there's a reason why he ended up being called Bitcoin Judas. And it was not because he supported big blocks. It was not because he supported, you know, wanting to make a fork. It's because he actively attacked everybody and everything that did not want to do what he wanted to do. Like, he smeared them. He said over and over, we're going to fire the devs. They suck. All the ones that they're now saying had consensus with him. He hated them, explicitly said they're going to fire them. When they instituted the EDA, it was explicitly because they said, we are going to harvest mining power from Bitcoin. We are going to kill it. We will not. Bitcoiners were literally saying, it's like, okay, fork off to your big block fork. Then we can go separate ways. We can bury the hatchet and we can just go on and we can just test both.
And if you're right,
and they said, we're free market and everything, but we're going to destroy you. Your network will not exist. All of these miners will come over to ours and you will die. Like, the idea that they were the good guys who were doing, who were being nice, and that, you know, Blockstream is the conspiracy, when look at Jihan Wu, who actually controlled the entire mining industry. He decided whether or not anybody got mining hardware, and he had an explicit technical exploit, which was a gross conflict of interest that SegWit as a soft fork got rid of. Totally by accident. He had a 20% advantage on something called Covert ASIC Boost, where you could get an advantage with your hardware that nobody else could tell whether or not you were doing it. And the upgrade that we were doing as a soft fork, as a backwards compatible soft fork or change upgrade to the network, it actually made that the ability to hide that not viable anymore. And it, because it was simply how the signatures and the hashes talk together.
Well, I learned something today. That's a new one for me. I didn't realize.
You didn't know Covert ASIC Boost? Yeah. No. That was what he was. And he is the one who got together everyone with the New York agreement and pulled everyone together and all the mining pool, 90% of the hash power agreed, 90% of the hash power all buy from Jihan Wu, and okay. Jihan Wu's going to tell
you. I knew that, but I didn't know about the underlying exploit, because while you're only studying Bitcoin, I'm studying Bitcoin, permaculture, biochar, aquaponics, yeah. right? So yeah. like I can't get everything, but that makes it all more true.
And you know what he proposed? SegWit 2x, which was okay. a hard fork version of that upgrade, and guess what didn't get negated? Covert ASIC boost. His version of it, which required a hard fork, was going to keep his advantage, his patented advantage, I would add. And so when he got a bunch of corporations and a bunch of big Bitcoin miners together, and they all agreed what was going to happen, and then Coinbase is just like publishing, this is what we're going to do now.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this, the people who have been on the subreddit, who have been on Bitcoin Talk forums, who have been on Twitter, who've been all these platforms. We have been screaming and arguing and fighting about this for years. And out of nowhere, a bunch of big, like, self-important, pompous corporate, like, exchanges and a bunch of big mining pools were going to get together and just decide, and now it was over and we had to swallow whatever stupid shit they came up with? Absolutely not. They are the ones that created the user-activated soft fork, because Coinbase literally came out and said, we have 40 million users. We speak on behalf of all of them. I was like, you don't speak on behalf of me, you sack of shit.
Like, no, you don't.
And that is exactly what happened. We just ran nodes and said, no.
No.
Not gonna
and
do
that's
it.
The beauty. That's the beauty of the consensus model. I've literally had people telling me shit that is just absolutely ridiculous recently, like only financial nodes get a say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know of a Bitcoin node that's not in some way at least potentially a financial node, but I think what they meant was exchanges and mining nodes. I'm like, no, a full node gets a say like any other fucking node. This is where I get wrong. You're trying to actually not just argue with it. I don't argue just to argue. There's no point to it. I like to people to get educated. And if I'm wrong, I want to know it. So then you give them conclusive proof of what you say, and they just say no. And that's, again, that's where we get back to have fun staying poor, because I can't give you more than facts. And if you're going to ignore facts without counterfacts, I'm done. I just don't know what else to say. And this whole mess.
It's the network of real people that matter. Yeah. You know, and, you know, they always have this thing that's like, oh, well, if Amazon owns half of the Bitcoin or something, then they control it. And it doesn't matter how many nodes you have of all the other people. But, like, imagine all you have to do is think about the scenario, right? Play out an extreme version of the scenario, and you can just understand where the spectrum is. Amazon cannot sustain their wealth by themselves. The reason Amazon is wealthy is because they give customers what they want. If a million customers are all running their own node, and it says this is how Bitcoin is and these are the rules, and then somebody who owns an enormous amount of Bitcoin forks off by themselves, it doesn't matter how wealthy they are.
No.
It's like saying that, like, I'm wealthy because I own, you know, 10,000 houses. And then if I burn down all of those houses, I'm still wealthy, even though the houses are the thing that are my wealth. Amazon's wealth are their customers. If they fork off from their customers, they aren't wealthy anymore. You can't sell an asset to nobody. Like, that's the only money is a network of communication. If you have, it's like forking off from the phone network to some other protocol and be like, well, I've got the best phone that there ever is. It's like, bitch, you can't call anybody. Like, and that is literally what a node does. It just defends your rules so that you maintain the network that you are on. And if nobody joins your network, they're not going to get wealthy off of you.
So go ahead and just kind of steer that into answering this right here, because this is I hear this all the time. Could a central bank take control of Bitcoin by buying up large quantities and fractionalizing it? This is cutting a sandwich into more pieces feeds the world, I guess. Like, all of a sudden, central banks.
No, I think they mean fractional reserve. Okay. I would assume that's what they're for the sake of argument. So, like, out of, you know, an abundance of caution, so we're not straw manning. Let's say they fractional reserve it, because that's the real.
So you're saying then the bank would put in 10,000 Bitcoin and then say we're issuing credits against it at a fraction?
Yes. Like, yeah, I imagine that's what they're saying, that it's not reserve. It's not full reserve. Yeah. Basically what happened to gold. I think gold is mentioned in it, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, they didn't mention gold, but I would assume that that's the analogy. Well, so why is that not really a risk? Well, A, it is a risk, but it's not a systemic one. Okay. Not like it is with gold. And there's a couple of different reasons why. There's always influence. Okay, yes, as a fractional reserve. Yep. I assume that's what it was. There are always going to be ways to control or get some level of manipulation over layers on top of it. But the underlying system itself is completely open and completely permissionless. And to understand why gold ended up the way it was, and it's the ease in which it was captured, is specifically because of the scale of settlement.
Okay.
It scales. It works when it's small. It sucks when it's huge. Every single Ponzi scheme, every fractional reserve system can manage with a bunch of small withdrawals. It falls apart under big withdrawals.
Okay.
You cannot big withdraw gold. You cannot take $1 trillion worth of gold out of a system quickly. It's the most Herculean task. It literally weighs 1 billion pounds. You know, extraordinarily difficult to move massive amounts of gold.
You need Ponzi scheme is never trailers or ships or airplanes.
You literally need ships. Like the French sent a warship to New York to get their gold out of the New York Fed just before they broke the gold window. They were denied, but they literally sent a military vessel to get their gold, and it did not work because they couldn't. And the settlement and the risk and the counterparty control that you have when your asset is that heavy. The reason gold was so easily captured is because it was literally physical, is because it scaled negatively. The bigger it got and the more value you were trying to move, the more difficult it is to do. The opposite is true with Bitcoin. A purchase of coffee and gold will never make the banking Ponzi go out. You know, you can do that with fractional reserve all day, but you cannot move $1 trillion worth of gold out of a bank and not pop that bubble.
Okay.
That is how you destroy a fractional reserve system. You can move a massive amount of Bitcoin instantly in 10 minutes. There is no way to sustain fractional reserve. For a few dollars.
Yeah.
It scales in the reverse. It's hard to do tiny payments on the global ownership, like the auction, the bidding war system of the chain itself. But you can, and it does work fantastically well for massive amounts of value. And massive amounts of value being exchanged and settled is exactly how you pop bubbles. It's exactly how you call the bluff on a fractional reserve.
So what about the people that take this a different way? Instead of saying fractional reserve, and they say things like, well, MicroStrategy could just dump all their Bitcoin and crash the market on purpose and then cause a fork, the first part, for a time anyway, sure. The second part, I don't even understand. Isn't this what Vera tried? Isn't that exactly what Roger tried? Like, I'm going to make it hurt so bad you'll pick up my shit. That didn't work. But I guess they have more, so they could do more damage, is the mindset. Crash their whole system now is based on Bitcoin doing well.
They would be taking massive losses on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
They would be taking huge losses on purpose.
You might as well put a Colt in your mouth and pull the trigger. It's
so the way to think about it, going back to the analogy, actually, really quick, is that the reason whatever happens to Bitcoin in terms of the context of control, it also doesn't really matter how much somebody has. So like somebody could buy up half of the Bitcoin. If they literally keep it off the market, that they don't exchange value and they don't do anything else with it, all it does is just make it appear as if there's less supply available. But talking about like MicroStrategy and stuff, and Michael Saylor is like, oh, he can dump it on the market. First, MicroStrategy is not going, like, they're saying that the price is going up because of MicroStrategy. They're like 1% or less of the liquidity. Like, they're a tiny portion of the liquidity. There is a massive bid underneath this thing. Like, there's no way that liquidity is like $100 billion a day or more. Like, it's huge. The idea that just because of that, again, it's one of those things that we look at the social layer and we're like, well, these two corporations agree, therefore everybody agrees. Like, if you just see Michael Saylor buying and it's like, well, Michael Saylor is the one buying. What if they stop buying? It's such a, we're so bad at understanding massive complex systems with billions of players. And that's what it is. And so what do? We point at like three of them. Yeah. And then we make a big hubbaloo about all of them.
BlackRock and Saylor.
They're the ones that do that. They're the ones that do that. And it just, but it's not reality. Like, they cannot crash the price in like some massive, massive way. They are a small amount of liquidity. A massive shift in the entire market could crash the price. But you know what happens? The price crashes. We've done that shit like eight times. As we're not going anywhere. Like, what could Bitcoin be better at surviving than price crashes? We've done it so many times. We eat that for breakfast, and then we have it again for a midnight snack. We've had 90% crashes. We've had 80% crashes. We've had 70% crashes. We do periodic 30 to 40% crashes just for fun. Who gives a shit? Sell it. Like, it's the fiat-minded bitch who grew up in a market where it's only supposed to go one way and it's supposed to be stable. You do not understand the people who have been built in the Bitcoin markets.
No. Like,
all you do is you have paper. You just have people. The bitches just get wiped out and everybody else buys from them. Everybody who's been here for a cycle is not concerned about the fact that we'll have a 50% drawdown.
How many shorters got their dick burnt off, like completely castrated by the market? Like, just that, watching that sell wall go down over 100K, that was fun. That was just, and you could just see as that sell wall was coming down, you could just see those short positions just getting wiped the fuck out. You're like, every cycle.
Shouldn't have done it.
They do it. Yeah. At the exact wrong, there is a time where if you're just a trader, there is a historical pattern. You probably can make some money shorting Bitcoin on the way down. And that I don't know if you'll be able to do it this cycle, but I've said that before and been wrong. But I'll tell you when you're not going to do it. November, December of the halving year, you have to be just a dumb fog, I'm sorry, to think that you're going to pull that off. It's like when it makes me think of, you know, that cartoon with the dude with the giant fork, sticking it in the giant electric socket. It says socialism. And the guy next to him says, everybody that ever did that got hurt. And he goes, they all did it wrong. When I see people shorting Bitcoin in that model, I'm like, there's the guy with the fucking fork, man. Watch. His ass is fixed. And he just like blows sparks out. Like, it's going to happen. And you know it's going to happen. And I think one of the things, that just listening to you talk, that I realized is we are the least selfish people in the world. Because when that happens, what do we say? Don't sell. If we were greedy fucks, you know what we'd be doing? Sell. Everybody sell. Because you know what you're doing. You're looking for more surplus capital when that shit comes down. You're buying as much as you can. So honestly, we would be.
Somebody was actually posting. So I've got like the Audionauts group of everybody who donates to the show. And we've been like a really tight crew for like a good number of years. And it was so funny. Somebody brought it up the other day. We were just kind of like waxing nostalgic about things that had happened, and he was like, you know, I remember in the crash, the flash crash in 2020, when it plummeted from like $7,000 down to like $3,000, you know, that everybody, like the entire room, the Audionauts room was wild. Everybody was freaking out about what they could sell to buy more Bitcoin. And I was telling this story because I was like, my first reaction actually when I saw the big fat red candle was, oh my God, something like huge happened. Like there's like a photography bug or something. And I went looking, I was like, just went typing, like what has happened? And like nothing had happened. It was a purely a liquidity event. It's a bunch of dummies, you know, just making bad decisions and probably a long squeeze, you know, who knows? But as soon as I realized like nothing had happened, I'd be like, oh my God. Oh my God, this is the best. I have to get into this now. And I immediately, we had this like big shelf thing with all these like little, nice little like divider things that my wife had built that was basically our filing cabinet. Mm-hmm. And I had all of this financial docs and all of this stuff. And I was like, I've got to have an IRA or something from an old job around here somewhere.
Something,
and I just been digging through, and it was like one of those scenes in one of the movies where they just have papers strewn about all over the floor, and it's like covering the floor. And my wife got home, and I was like, I found $3,000 in my old job's IRA, and we're going to get it, and Bitcoin has crashed. It went down like 60% today. And she was like, what is wrong with you?
what are you so giddy about, right?
We literally were like wigging out, and everybody was like, I could sell this. I could do this. I got rid of our extra car during that whole span. I didn't get to sell it until it was like back up to like five or six. But we put everything, I paid, you know, fees and taxes on this thing. I dumped it into Bitcoin, everything that we could. And it was just so funny because it was like 4 days of everybody losing their minds trying to buy Bitcoin as fast as we could. If Michael Saylor flash crashed the market and did that, you have no idea. Anybody who's been here for a couple of years, how freaking excited we would be. The idea that I could get Bitcoin again at $40,000 after we went to 108, just because Saylor made a bad decision, is amazing.
And God help golden. You. If all of us that are homeowners, if that happens and they put interest rates back down to like 2.8%, like I got on my mortgage right now, because I would extract the fuck out of that equity at that interest rate. I probably wouldn't know where it is now, but you'll like this one. So it was one of those crashes. It wasn't quite that deep. I ended up getting like half a Bitcoin for it. But when I was in my shitcoin phase, I also mined, and I mined shitcoins. And I found this, I think it was a Zcash wallet or something on one of my PCs, and I opened it up. And it had done kind of well since I had mined it. And there was like $3,500 worth of Zcash in that wallet. And I'm like, oh, fuck, Bitcoin, baby. And just instantly, I think it was like, I bought like half a coin in one transaction while that market was down. And I think that, you know, mining might not be the right term, but it's the term we're stuck with from Satoshi because it's really more verifying transactions. But I guess that doesn't work for people's minds. But I think minted is a good word, too. And I think that what gets minted in Bitcoin isn't Bitcoins. It's maxis. And it's these cycles riding through at least one full cycle all the way through, coming out the other end. And whether you're stupid or not, it doesn't matter. If you go through it and you don't come out with zero and you watch it come back, you're inoculated for real. Mm-hmm. And then the more times that happens to you, the more impervious you can care about this. Like when it hit 107 recently, and the only reason I knew about it is somebody in a live stream that wasn't about Bitcoin told me. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I wouldn't even have known it happened. I don't care about the price. It's not – I'm not in my time-focused frame yet where I care. Like I'm old, but I ain't that old yet. This is forever money for me. So I don't care what it does tomorrow other than the more it goes down, the more I can buy. That's the only thing I care about.
Yeah. And there's – just in the idea of like big players like going to sell, it's like one of those things like to not recognize what you're comparing against, and to understand that you're saying, I mean, China could crash the bond market tomorrow,
sure,
like just eviscerate it. So what, in fact, that would be worse than what was going on in Bitcoin, and the bond market would have such a massive loss of faith, like a staggering loss of faith, because it's supposed to be this incredibly safe thing that it is the structure, is the core, and is the foundation of all of our money. And yet nobody's going to lose faith in Bitcoin if it takes a 50% plummet. Nobody that actually knows anything about Bitcoin, it'll be the same stupid people who already don't have faith in it. They're like, see, I told you so. But Bitcoin does this all the time. Like, nobody's going to think, like, oh, foundationally, something is wrong. It's like, oh, business as usual. Let's do this again. Let's do this again sometime. It'll be wonderful.
This is one of your posts from recent, your reposts, anyway. China's 10-year yield.
Oh, yes. All that.
Oof. that's hard, bro.
They're all going, man, they're going to have to print again. It's an interesting political situation in the U.S. because I think there's going to be a lot of pressure. I'm still inclined to think that there will not be any fundamental change because it's too systemic. It's too built into like how things work. And that we're more likely to just kind of have like the biggest branches cut off that we've had in a long time. And, but then, you know, every bush, you cut the branches off any bush or any tree and it grows back, you know.
And it grows back bigger and thicker and heavier.
A lot of times it does.
Yeah. It's called pollarding. It's like, it's a way to create infinite wood resource is mm-hmm. we do this in permaculture. You take a tree, a pollard is high and the coppice is low and about, you know, head height, a nice working height. You just take the whole top of the tree off. And instead of one tree root coming back, it branches out and it actually creates this gnarly look to it. And that's basically the plant's stem cells. And it starts multiplying itself and becoming stronger because you're growing back, but you already have the root system of the giant tree. And that, in a way, is a lot like Bitcoin. Like, the harder you hit it and the more it sustains, the more people gain faith in it. And the more people that gain faith in it, the harder it is to attack. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really is like the, you know, like Rogue or something in X-Men where you go at them and then they take your power from you. And the harder you hit them, the stronger they become. That's really how this all works. And it's, I think a big part of why people have a hard time with this is there's almost nobody alive right now that lived with true hard money as a standard.
Yeah.
You would have had to have been alive in 1912, which if you are still around, good for you.
And understood what that meant in 1912.
Yeah, right. And understood what it meant. So you would have been
You can't be like 2 years old in 1912. Yeah. That didn't mean anything.
Even if you were alive prior to 71, many people were. You were already on a fractional gold system. Mm-hmm. And we had already winnowed it away. 64, they took away the silver. And they demonetized silver. And I think what another thing is people don't realize that was a default. In 1964, the Coinage Act was a default on the American money system. 33 was a default. 1913 was a default. The crime of 1873 was a default. These were defaults on the monetary system. But at least if you go back into that time, the idea that you could save your way into wealth at retirement was a thing, mm-hmm. right? You didn't have to risk your money. You could just keep whatever you didn't spend and keep piling it up and maybe do some investing, maybe do some lending at an interest rate that was reasonable. Maybe invested in a business, but you didn't have to go out and buy an index fund to become wealthy when we had hard money. You could store the value there and over a lifetime it accumulated. Then whatever was left after you died, you give it and your family could keep doing it. No one alive has experienced that until now. So it's foreign. Like what I say about Bitcoin investing is that the problem with it is the same reason people can't understand the fractional monetary system. The concept is so simple, the mind is like, no, fuck that. It can't be that simple. The whole rules are, and every day with more sats than you started with, no shit coining, the dollar is currency, Bitcoin is money, don't sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Done. That's it. And when you tell somebody that, they're like, no, I want to buy your 375-page ebook that gives me the super solution to becoming wealthy or something in my underwear at my kitchen table. Like they want it to be something complicated, but while the technology is complicated, while SHA-256 is complicated, et cetera, the thing you need to do is simple. Yeah. It's simple. Because how well did you know your grandparents and kind of like what was their time they came up in?
Really well. And in fact, they had a lot of habits that went through the Great Depression and stuff. Like they had the tendency to save plates and
save money, and, you know, save glasses, cash, save things,
you know,
right?
Like all of those sorts of things. So it was, and it's interesting to see that dichotomy, you know.
Yeah.
Like they never grew up in a world of 0% consumer debt that like, oh, get 0% for 12 months on a car. You know, it was absolutely insane. I mean, you think about it, all you have to do is realize if you look at your own framing and like what you would rent out to somebody else for 0%, you realize how absurd it is that it's only because you're chasing new money and that you can turn around and sell it to somebody else and somebody else can get the debt at a lower interest that any of this makes any sense. Like there's no economic sense whatsoever. Think about it at a 1% interest rate that we loan corporations, banks get it from the Fed, 1%, 2%. Imagine that in the context, and we're talking about billions and trillions of dollars.
Yes.
Right. Like country buying amounts of money at this rate. Find one thing that you own, one thing that you would own that you would rent to somebody at 1%. Like rent your lawnmower, your $2,500, $3,000 lawnmower to somebody else at 1%. That means $25 a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's crazy. You would never, it costs you $25. It costs you $50 to mow your lawn once to hire somebody else. And you're going to give your lawnmower away. And at the end of the year, it's going to be worth $1,500.
Yep.
Because they've mowed with it all year long, and you're going to take $2.05 a month for that? That's what you're going to rent it for? Money is resources. Money is a reflection of the resources that they have available to them. They could that corporation that got a billion-dollar loan could literally just go out and buy – what was it? 400,000 lawnmowers, or 400 million lawnmowers, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They could literally just go buy that. They are basically getting the rent of that many lawnmowers for 1%.
Or they could borrow $1 billion at 1% and loan it back to the government that created it at 2%. Yeah.
And you know what they do? They do exactly that. They buy up a whole bunch of lawnmowers and then they rent them back out at a price that actually makes some sort of sense. And what happens is they own the whole world. They buy all the houses. They buy all the land. They buy all the cars. They buy everything so that they own the structure of the world and everyone rents or mortgages it from them. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they created more value than everybody else. It's that they got preferential interest rates that are impossible unless you are printing money out of thin air. And suddenly they own everything. They're the banks are the biggest buildings in every single city. That's ridiculous. The banks don't make anything. They're an accounting thing.
There's no need to even have a building, honestly.
Could
be a giant bank could be run out of a building the size of my house.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Right? There's no need for any bank. I don't think
they were small. They were small.
Yeah.
They used to be.
Yeah. I don't think there'll be many physical banking locations left in another 10 years.
Yeah.
Not because they're going to become, saints or something and go away.
I think there will be. They'll just be very, very different. Just because physical security around keys and hardware, I think the custodian model and the idea of multi-sig and federations and proof of reserves and all of these things, I think there's – everybody's like, oh, what about retail payments? Like, I think there's an ocean – like a $50 trillion market just in – not as in like you could pay $50 trillion in fees. I mean there will be $50 to $100 trillion tied up in systems of proof of reserves, of multi-sig setups, of distributing security so that there's no physical risk and there's no kidnapping risk and there's no I've got a car accident and I have my keys in my pocket risk. Like, I think there's such a unique and – unbelievably incredible technology and being able to legitimately split up sovereign keys and have time locks and have, tying a subsidiary payment network to an exact amount of Bitcoin somewhere is wild. There are so many things that you can do with this. And the fact that this is an open and permissionless network, like Lightning is such a great example, I brought this up with Clint. When I was on the show with Clint talking or debating with Steve, is that to fail to recognize how insane it is that literally for like the last 7 years in Bitcoin, I have used tons of custodial services just out of playing with them, custodial wallets or this, that, or the other, like all these little tools. I had a little Zap thing in my Telegram.
Yeah.
And every single one of them was owned and operated, was run by someone that I personally know.
Okay.
Like literally a friend. And I would just be like, yo, UTXO, like how's the server going? It's like, oh, well, I'll do your Telegram thing. That is not even remotely possible in a financial, in a fiat environment.
Hmm.
It's an entirely permissioned system. Just that alone, I hope can make people realize that we have genuinely moved from the three broadcast companies to the internet layer.
Yeah.
Sure, not everybody's going to run their own website, But you can have anyone run a website, and you can get a microservice, or you can, a 14-year-old in their garage has a permissionless global system and payments network to build whatever the hell they want to build and to provide whatever service completely without permission to anyone that they want to provide it to. I am able to run Lightning services for people in my family. That's crazy. That is insane. And we are still so early. We still have so many other things that we can build on top of this. We're just barely scratching the surface with where this can go.
Well, and I think that there's also even some of the things that are more corporate or whatever, like, you know, Primal has a native wallet now.
Yeah.
I think people should self-custody. I'm a huge advocate. I've been that forever. But if you have $50 in a Primal wallet, I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I don't care any more than if you had, you know, 10 $5 bills in your front pocket of your jeans. Could you lose it? Yes. Will it alter your life if you lose it? No. Does the government really give a fuck about your $50? Unless it's on a W-2 or something? No. I don't give a shit that it's – I don't care about any of that shit. It's KYC, whatever. It's fucking $50, $5, whatever. It's zaps flying around on Noster. What I say is when it gets up to a number where you start to say, like, I'm going to hurt if this money's gone, take most of it off and move it to something you have custody over. And we're there is this purist among us, I guess, like this purist niche within the maxi niche of everything needs to be no KYC. Nothing can be collective at all. Everything needs to be independent. Like, and it's like they hate the ETFs. Right. They hate that. That's awful. They hate government doing a reserve or whatever. It's like, wait a minute. You fuckers have been talking about Bitcoin, hyper Bitcoinization for 15 fucking years. You've been talking about this. What did you think you were talking about? If you have the best monetary instrument there is,
do you think you would just like stop people you didn't like from getting in it? Like, that's the whole point of Bitcoin. Like, how did you not realize that you weren't going to be able to say no to an ETF? Yeah. We're going to be able to say no to the United States government buying it. Like, the hyper-Bitcoinization means that everybody you don't like is also going to be here.
Yeah.
And if you thought Bitcoin wasn't going to survive that, that the ETFs are the death knell of Bitcoin, like, that's it. The boom, ring the bell, we're done. Because the ETF showed up. Like, why were you even here? How did you ever believe in Bitcoin if you thought all it needed was an ETF and then it was dead? That was it. We're done.
You have the conversation. You're like, okay, so do you believe that Bitcoin's better money than a dollar? Yes. Are you opposed to the dollar having a dollar ETF? No. I don't even know what to say next. Right? Like, what did you think they were going to do? What? There's an ETF for nickel. There's an ETF that specifically invests in things that are for diabetics. Right? There's an ETF for – I don't care what you come up with. I guarantee you there's an ETF for it. The reason I was pro-ETF is, one, I knew it would work out in the end to make us wealthier. But two is, just on principle, if you can have an ETF for nickel, then you should be able to have an ETF for the most verifiable asset on the planet, because, you know, it's going to be paper, Bitcoin, whatever. We know the fucking addresses, folks. Did you see the thing that came out like 2 weeks ago? BlackRock moved, which really their custodian Coinbase moved. Their Bitcoin to a bunch more addresses. Of course, they said wallets. I'm like, those aren't wallets. They're addresses. But they basically split it up in a bunch more addresses. Well, that would be intelligent, right? You don't want to hold $200 billion or whatever it is.
I'm one key and one
out. Of course they did. But then the conspiracy shit started flowing out of it, right? You know, it's like these people don't know how an ETF works. BlackRock doesn't own – well, I'm sure BlackRock owns some Bitcoin. But that ETF itself – most of that's not BlackRock's money.
Yeah. That's one of those arguments that just gets me. They say, and this is one of the things that they said all the, like, during the block size wars and all this stuff, is that, like, oh, well, the miners will just not go and you'll be screwed.
Yeah.
And it was just like, do you really think it's so simple that this is how flatly and easily this works? That there won't be a response to this? Like, is your whole model just built on the fact that, like, all the people will just kind of throw their hands up? Like, it doesn't cost me anything to run a node and just wait.
Yeah.
You don't realize how easy it is to, like, to not follow them, to put them on, to basically call their bluff. And that's exactly what we did. okay, go mine a shitcoin. If you want to do that, and all of the nodes of the network stay on our network, you can't sell your new forked coin to anybody. And you have hundreds of thousands of dollars of cost every 10 minutes. It costs us nothing to wait. I will sit around and wait. And in fact, you say we don't even use it for retail payments anyway. So what are you taking from us? We're all just holding it in cold storage anyway. Yeah. I'm just going to sit around. And I'm going to keep my cold storage on the rules that I want and on the network I want. And I'll buy some more Bitcoin to whichever miner decides to mine on my chain. If you think that the miners are going to be the ones that denote and not the network of people who accept it, who say, sure, I'll buy your coin. Like, it's the same thing with BlackRock. Is they say, like, well, BlackRock now has all of these coins. It's like, dude, they don't. They're allocated to other people. They own it on behalf of literally millions and millions of people in the United States. Their retirements and equity funds and hedge funds and all of these things that are allocated to this. So, okay, so BlackRock has, let's say, I don't even know how many they have. There's a crap ton of coins, right?
Yeah.
So the theory goes that BlackRock is going to create a client in which they fork off to utterly, like, to fundamentally change the rules of the network, and that when they do this, they're going to force everybody else to do it, because they're going to steal all of the coins for the millions of users which their ETF is legally obligated to hold for them.
Yeah.
And they are going to dump it on Bitcoin. They're going to dump it on Fidelity, who owns their own. They're going to dump it on Grayscale, who owns their own. And they're going to completely change it. We're all going to have to shift over to BlackRock coin, and nobody's going to do anything. Like, there's going to be no response to this whatsoever. Like,
they don't really own shit anyway. Their clients own
it. Think through it. We can't add CTV. We couldn't raise the block size without 5 years of vicious screaming and shit throwing and spamming and DDoSing and fake nodes and fake this and just attacks outright. And you think BlackRock is going to take over and everybody's just going to be like, damn it, we had a really good run. But BlackRock did it. Now we're, God, what are we going to do? BlackRock coin. I just, like, think. Just think about it. The utter shitstorm. BlackRock would go out of business. That would literally kill BlackRock. They would get DDoSed, and I would participate so bad. Like, it would be utterly insane. It would be glorious, actually, to watch that unfold. If they literally thought that they were arrogant enough that they could do that, part of me just wants to go, give it a shot, you know, man? Like more power to you, buddy. Come on, let's take over Bitcoin, BlackRock. I have faith in you, because I really hope BlackRock just ends up poor. Like, I hope the whole system crushes underneath them, and that would be the best decision that they could make to ensure that that happens. So go right ahead. You fork Bitcoin and you dump those coins, because there's nothing we can do, buddy. There's nothing.
Anybody can fork anything they want anytime they want to fork it. They can fork right off, right? Like, now, here's something, too. Like, it's not like ETFs are a place that holds you forever. So what I've got is a tool that was built on Dune, and this is ETF inflows since inception early this year. And if you look at the bottom of that graph and you look at the purple, that's Grayscale. Mm-hmm. And you can see Grayscale's holdings have gone down dramatically since then, because they've kept their fees high. Now, I'm not going to pick on them, because I know what they did. They did math. And they said, we could lose 80% of our customers and still be ahead. So we're not going to drop our fees with everybody else. And we'll see how long that works out for them. So far, it has. The math works out that if they had cut their fees, it wouldn't really be that great. They also had a huge dump in the beginning because people were holding it till conversion.
Yeah, they just had so many people trapped and there was going to be a big dump anyway. So they.
But my point is, look at, there's not other options there. There's a lot of places taking a lot of volume. It's not only
Fidelity has custodied their own the whole time.
Like, yeah,
Fidelity has been awesome.
Have you heard this one? Don't sell your Bitcoin to BlackRock. I don't even understand. Yeah. Like, what do you mean don't sell my Bitcoin to BlackRock? I'm not going to sell my Bitcoin to anybody. But what are you talking about? Like, you know, or don't sell your Bitcoin to Sailor or whatever. Like, it hurts my brain. So what Hogus is asking, let me find this again.
Hoskus.
He told me how to pronounce his name at an event, and I still don't know how to do it. I couldn't do it with him there telling me how to say that.
Genesis?
Yeah. What he's talking about, I think, is quantum.
Oh, is Genesis the name of their quantum chip or whatever that Google did?
Can you talk about that for a minute and just roll for a second? I'll be right back. I'm not gone.
Yeah, no worries. So the quantum thing is the most frustrating thing, because I have tried so hard to steal man and try to find something like really concrete about quantum, and it is the most hyped up, jargon filled bunch of crap I have ever had to dig into. Like, it's worse than most like white papers for shitcoins, in my opinion. I've even talked with people on social and then ended up in DMs with them trying to get somebody to find me something concrete. And I've gone down this rabbit hole a few times. So the whole thing of like Google like did a computation that would take a conventional computer the entirety of like the history of the universe and all the energy of the universe in order to do, like, this thing is a benchmark created specifically for the way quantum computers work today in order to do a computation that is difficult to do on conventional computers. And it is not, they've actually made the same claim before. The last time they had a big like step up in quantum, which was like, I think it was like 5 years ago, they had like 40 qubits or 45 qubits, whatever it was, that they did the same thing, and that no conventional computer could do it. It would take them 100 million years. And then literally in that span, we actually found a way for conventional computers to do that computation, because it's just not they've basically created the environment for their experiment so this thing can pass with flying colors. But there's no indication that they have so many problems with error correction. They have so many problems with scaling this thing up to like basically, I think they've got like 105 qubits now for the computational density, and for a real computation, for like actually putting in SHA-256, or well, ECDSA is really the thing, is to put in a cryptographic algorithm. The level of complexity, the level of parallelism, and the level of error correction is so, I mean, we're talking orders of magnitude on top of orders of magnitude out of the realm. We're talking about millions of qubits needed. And we've moved from like 40 to 105 in like 5 or 7 years. So it's like, I think it's a doubling every 5 years is the expectation right now, which puts us at a million in a very, very long time. Like 50 years maybe. Trying desperately to get something concrete out of it. I remember I was talking with a quantum maximalist, I guess is the term to use.
Quantum maximalist.
Somebody who is certain and also very like knowledgeable and understands the theories. He did a pretty good job of explaining it. I kept saying but what is it done that's like practical? Like, don't give me some like randomized like function test that's like perfect for quantum computers and then just tell me it can do it better than conventional. Like, you're telling me that crypto is broken. Like, give me something that quantum can't do that it can now do that is specific to conventional computers, and how well does it perform? It says, well, it factored a semi-prime number. And if, you know, it factored numbers, then that's the problem, right? Like, factoring numbers is the quantum, I mean, is the encryption problem, is how do you get a semi-prime number and how do you factor it quickly?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, that's crazy. Okay, that is significant. Can you tell me where that was? And I dug through like 20, I don't even know, countless articles that were pointing to this claim. None of them had a source. None of them have a source. God, it's so infuriating when you cannot find where the thing is coming from that people are talking about. And he finally sent it to me, and I went digging through, and they tried so hard not to say what it was. And finally, when I found out the big breakthrough and the thing that's going to break cryptography, because you have 256-bit numbers that you can factor, the number that they factored with one of the most advanced quantum computers was like the number 17. It was two digits. And I was like, and the hours I wasted to find this is so infuriating. I could not believe that. I was like, this can't be real. This can't be the thing that you're telling me is the threat. Like, let's get to like factoring like a digit, three digits before we talk about factoring with like 64, you know, like just, it's exhausting.
Well, and there's nothing that says you have to maintain the level of encryption you have, that we can't expand that. So what I've heard the most informed people say is it's easier to defend from quantum to develop than to develop it. So making it harder,
resistant tech, like that's not even, you know, when it becomes clear that we're factoring 20 digit numbers,
then we can start worrying.
It would be so crazy in comparison to what the capabilities are now. Well, okay. Well, then let's get the best quantum algorithm, you know, and we can put that in the signature and voila.
And then you'll need a quantum ASIC.
Yeah.
I mean, if you develop a computer that good at it, the most profitable thing to do with it would be to participate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the other side of it.
I will say it's not something to ignore.
No,
it's not something to ignore, but be sober about it. You know, like everything is hype. And also remember that tech is desperate for funding. They push the whole I've got AI in my tool really bad. Like they've been on the cusp of so many dramatic changes in the market that they want the next thing, big thing, to be literally a huge thing again. And so they're looking for it. And so they hype up everything to be the next thing that's going to get them $100 billion in funding or a trillion in government contracts, you know, all this stuff. So everything's going to sound great, but what'd you do with it?
That's the other thing.
What was the computation? Explain that to me.
That's an age thing too. Like, were you old enough to be cognizant of what was going on through the dot-com boom? And then you've seen this multiple iterations of, this dynamic thing is going to change the world as we know it. And then it comes and it really kind of wah-wahs. It doesn't. It just doesn't happen. I mean, there's certain things that if you watch, I bet you could make a graph. Somebody probably has, that shows over time the most common words used in VC proposals. And then go back and look at that graph and see how many of those things have really become what anybody said they were going to become, right? I'm sure you remember this. This one was all in the crypto space, right? Blockchain, not Bitcoin.
Blockchain, everything.
That was in every VC proposal. My own investment advisor was spouting it to me, and I'm like, we'll see. And no, because blockchains are contentious. Blockchains are hard. Blockchains are slow. Mm-hmm. There's a reason you have
it's a global auction. I just don't understand. Yeah. Like, it's crazy that people don't look at how it works and then not stop and think, like, this is not a payment network. This is not Visa, and you can't make this Visa. So why is it? Ask, why is it succeeding if it isn't Visa?
Yeah,
it clearly isn't. If you have a global auctioning system, a global bidding war going on for space in this chain, for these transactions to be done, and it does not apply to what you are thinking it applies to, that it's not the same model, and it has massive sets of trade-offs and different actions and how it behaves and the fact that you can have weather. Like, imagine if like payments just started not going through on Christmas, like as you're buying Christmas presents, because too many people are trying to buy Christmas presents. Like, you would just stop using whatever that thing is. It does not work for retail. But I don't know. I guess it just sounds good. I mean, people would put blockchain in their company title that had nothing to do with it, and their stock would shoot up like 20%. You know, it just so it is what it is.
Yeah. You know, and there is a certain level of technological threat to every form of money, right? Like, what really killed gold was one, an intention to kill gold, but it was also that gold doesn't move. Mm-hmm. Gold is not frictionless. It's not weightless. It doesn't go at the speed of light. You have to trust somebody to hold it for you if you get beyond a few coins. And even it's so valuable that there's a fractionalization problem. Like, if I want to buy something from you that's relatively cheap, I need silver. I can't use a gram of gold is not, it's not worth producing. It takes more money to produce a gram of gold as a certified gram than it's worth. So it doesn't make sense. So when we got into a point with computers where we could send electronic payments unless the trusted party really can be trusted, and it never can, mm-hmm. especially if there's no option. If there's one trusted party, you're really not going anywhere. The dollar and the modern Western currencies defeated gold and were able to function as a fiat system. And people say it doesn't work. It worked for 50 years. It's still here. You get paid in it most likely while you're saying that. And there's a finite limit to it, but there was a technological thing that crushed gold, at least on some level. And it makes me think of, I've been listening to the latest book you've done the narration on the audio side for, Lynn Alden's Broken Money, and you were talking about the stones, right? The rice stones, and how when these people, I don't remember who it was, some explorer finds this island, and like they're going like 200 miles in a canoe to get this mm-hmm. stone to mint these, to make these stones that represent money on this island. And since they had better technology, they could just start cranking out stones, and they basically destroyed the monetary worth of these stones to a large degree, and basically mm-hmm. enslaved the island by a technological capability by breaking the money. When we talk about quantum as a threat, it's that same angle of attack, right? Yeah. So anybody who has a monetary system, the most important thing is, can you defend it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually the brilliance of Bitcoin, the consensus model and the difficulty adjustment. Those two things together make it highly defendable. And what people yeah. say is, well, it won't be around forever. I don't know. I can't say that. Someday the sun will eat the earth. I'm sure it won't survive that unless we're interplanetary with Elon by then. Mm-hmm.
Cryptography does historically have a shelf life.
Yeah.
It does tend to like have huge shifts. But that's why, you know, existential issues will always have, will be the only thing that we have consensus on making changes for, I believe. But I completely agree. And, you know, Liberty Cast says, you know, it changes the nature of computing. I also, like, I mean, it does in a sense with so many things, but it also doesn't in the sense of a lot of conventional computation. Is that there's plenty of things that quantum computers will never do because it doesn't make any sense to have a quantum computer do. It's specific types of computation that quantum computers can actually do. When you have vast, huge, complex models with lots of different outputs, but because of that, they also have not only do they have a staggeringly high cost to actually be built and have an infrastructure for, but they only are applicable to a very small subset of types of computation anyway. So there's a huge like imbalance. And I think that's why it's going to be Bitcoin mechanic. That's wrong. But I think that's why, like, even if it, as it happens or as, you know, progress in quantum computing, clearly there are quantum computations, regardless of error correction and all the problems of creating a bajillion different states and scaling yeah. that to actually pick the right one, so to speak, is that it does exist, and it will probably be applicable to something. But the question is it a $1 trillion application? And does anybody actually think that the investment will break ECDSA? Because nobody's going to make the investment if they don't. And I think that's why these things are so overhyped, is because they know that if it's not feasible in the short term, it's going to take 10 times longer. Like things speed up as you get closer to where it actually becomes applicable. And yeah. I still just think it's a type of computation that just is not broadly applicable. We're not going to be running normal software. I'm never going to be doing this podcast over a quantum computer. Like, there's zero reason for it. It's not going to be better at making a simple connection and doing linear computation to run some sort of a process.
Well, let's look at it this way, guy. Let's say that I magically waved my wand here and I made a super quantum computer that can break any encryption out there. And I did this and it appeared in front of you. Are you going to hack the Bitcoin network or the United States government, the Russian government, the Japanese government, the Chinese government, Bank of America, Citibank? Like, where would you go with that capability first? Would you go after Bitcoin or the entire banking system?
Yeah. Yeah. It really will be for like breaking into the communications of anything that it can get into. But I also just think the the runway is just not at all what people think it is. And again, I'm not a quantum expert. It's just something that annoys the crap out of me every time I try to get like some base of knowledge in it.
Yeah.
And it just, I hate stuff when people act like it's not explainable.
Yeah.
And they hide behind the inability to understand it as if that means it's important. And if that means it, like it's super, like it's like only smart people can believe it. It's like, nah, dude, like everything is understandable. Like you got the same monkey brain as I do. If you can't explain it, then I'm less likely to believe anything is actually there.
You know, see, and I think like, there's analogies too with quantum to like LLMs, right? AI. Like ChatGPT can ask it about anything, but it's a lot of times it's wrong. Even yeah. when it believes that it's right. You'll even say, I don't think that's
intelligence. It's yeah. not intelligence.
It's not.
Like, you actually understand. That was another rabbit hole that I went yeah. down and yep. trying to understand right. how it works. It pulls, right. it is much closer to a translation and compression algorithm.
It's exactly it is.
It is not actually making decisions, and the fact that it sounds like I
but I guess what I'm saying is, like, if you think yeah. about quantum, like if you purposely build a quantum computing system mm-hmm. to do a certain thing, it can be really good at the one thing you built it to do. If you yeah. make it a generalist, it's not so great. Same with an LLM. Like if you get a bunch of herpetologists together and they develop an LLM specifically dedicated to amphibians and reptiles, because that's what all these guys know is amphibians and reptiles, and that's what they care about. It will blow away ChatGPT's ability to tell you about herpetology subjects. The mm-hmm. more typecast you make the thing, the more you specialize it, the better it does the thing. It's like we teach about livestock, and you have like, I want a meat chicken and an egg layer. Well, then you want two different chickens, because if it's a generalist, it's okay at both, but it's not great at either. But yeah. if you buy a it's been bred to lay eggs, it'll crank out eggs. And if you want it to grow fast and be a meat chicken, it's probably not going to do that great as an egg layer.
Yeah.
Right? So you want something specific built. So to do this, you're going to spend all this money to build a computer that is specifically designed to break the Bitcoin network rather than, you know, I don't know, topple global governments.
And the thing to understand, too, is that like that principle is so important. I love that you hit on that, is the yeah. idea of specialization in the hardware versus generalization. And I genuinely, from what I've dug into, it seems to be like way, way more important for quantum than it even is for generic computation or traditional computation, so to speak, is that the only way I see like if quantum computers ever get powerful enough to actually break ECDSA to find the private key relevant to a public key, and they yeah. go for, you know, the 30% of coins that are still locked up in, you know, one PK blah blah, you know, whatever address is the old
Satoshi stash, right?
Satoshi stash, you know.
Yeah.
What it will do, or how we will know, and when it will be broken, will be. This is, I'll go ahead and make this prediction.
Okay.
I don't know what kind of decades long timeline we're talking about here. It literally could still be 30 to 50 years. Like, I don't know, but it will be a single $1 billion. Well, in today's dollars,
yeah.
quantum computer that the chip has hardwired. Like the chip itself can only run the process of that singular public key of a single address, and it can do absolutely nothing else. And it's yeah. going to take a 15-year investment, and it's going to be the biggest, it's going to be the most insane thing, and nobody else will be at risk, because yeah. it will literally take another $1 billion and another entirely custom directed at your public key, which nobody's even using anymore, at your public key quantum computer that's just, I mean, it will literally require one of the most ridiculous investments at the highest possible risk of like, is this even going to work? That is the only way I see it happening. And I just don't think there's going to be this huge leap to like, oh, I can just stick anybody's public key in here and just like, click,
yeah,
here's your private. You know, like it just.
That's too many movies where
they have
a little box and he comes into the thing and he sticks it on top of the computer and it breaks the encryption in 5 seconds. Like that's a nice story. So is, you know, quantum drives and slipstream drives on Star Trek and whatever. But that's also just a story, and the mind. I also think that there's a lot of people that are spouting that they just hate Bitcoin. So they're just looking for something, anything. And then sometimes it breaks through to people.
You know, yeah, yeah. It's just like, well, you know, when your other arguments feel flatter and they don't, it's like, oh, well, it'll drop the price. And you're
Bitcoin. Satoshi's picture is going to show and laugh at you and disintegrate the code or something. That's what Schiff said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's 21.55. I'll be dead. I don't give a fuck. All right. Yeah. I don't even think it's going to happen, but I just, I mean, that's, if it did, I promise you, no matter how much I do to take care of myself, I will not be around at 21.55. I won't be here. You know, like you know, I don't know, unless they make a quantum jack or I can download my brain. And I think that'll happen before fucking quantum breaks Bitcoin. I really do.
Probably.
Yeah, you'll be able to.
I think we'll have enough of a runway that it just won't, like, we'll just update. We'll, you will actually soft fork the signatures and, you know, like how it, I don't see it as being, when computation becomes that, we're literally talking about a time in which computation is so low cost. It wouldn't matter that our key, that our public key system is, you know, 10 times the size, like the data hog and the weight of all of these things. And it would necessarily mean that, you know, we've been building layers and layers on top of this thing and we have all of this other stuff. It's, well, yeah, okay, then it makes economic sense to actually make that change and take that trade-off at the base layer. But I just don't think it's stay on it. You know, I think it's important that we keep looking at it and we keep making sure that there isn't some sort of a huge leap, but I do not see the trend. I do not see the indication that there is any giant leap around the corner and that any of our cryptographic is at risk of a quantum attack. And I totally could be wrong, but
I put the same FUD category
I just don't see it.
The same FUD category is, but when they turn off the internet, man, because like if the internet is down globally, permanently, or even long term, the last
that guy's thing, got no cash in his pocket who's saying that.
The last thing I'm going to be fucking worried about at that point is my Bitcoin. Know what I mean? Like the world's burning, and you're you know, like, do you think you're fucking 401k plan is going to be okay if that happens? And do you think the people that you're talking with,
your credit card or debit card?
Those people depend on the internet more than I fucking do.
Yeah.
Right. They need it more than me. Like, that's like, if you don't do what I say, I'll shoot myself in the head. Bye. Right. I it makes me think of what was the funny ass movie in the 70s, Blazing Saddles. Mm-hmm. Right. Everybody back up and I won't say the rest. Right. Like, pointing the gun at yourself and everybody like going, oh my God, don't do it. Yeah, pull the trigger, man. Go ahead. What is Adrian asking here? What are the three top important things about Bitcoin that are misunderstood or unknown from your perspective?
Oof.
As soon as I saw the name, I knew it'd be a good question.
Yeah. Definitely the intrinsic value utility one. Okay. So deeply misunderstood. And everybody is, people don't realize that money is its own utility. Like, being a good money is massively valuable by itself. And it is not about the fact that you can do something else with it. Every consequence. One of the interesting things that you'll see in history, and, you know, they talk about this with the Mises' regression theorem and stuff, is that, oh, it has to have some other, you have to do some other thing with it. That is not the thing to learn from the history of money. Because one of the things you'll notice is that every single money in history had no common external utility. There was nothing about it that required it to be one particular thing or one, like glass beads have been money. Seashell, like polished seashells have been money, like literal money for centuries. Those big giant rhinestone rocks, literally rocks that did nothing, were money for 5 centuries.
Because they were
double the entire era of fiat, more than double the entire era of fiat money. 5 centuries it worked. Why? Because it worked as a good money. It wasn't a payment network either. You couldn't move the damn things. They're huge. In fact, the only they would barely change hands. Most of them just sat where they were. They acted as an impenetrable or an irrefutable ledger as to who owned what. Is it like, well, this thing of big value sitting on top of this hill now belongs to somebody else? It's about making a record-keeping system with high integrity. And not only is the ability to hold value without counterparty risk, which is what money does, how do you have something that is radically neutral, that no matter how much value you put into it, it cannot be artificially diluted? That's it. That's the problem. Because then you can communicate that value with other people. But the problem is, how do you have money? How do you have value without counterparty risk? You can't do it with a house. Counterparty risk, it rots. It's hard to move. I mean, there's like a million different reasons why houses suck, even though real estate has basically become the de facto money for the United States, like middle class and stuff. It has enormous trade-offs. That problem is a $100 trillion problem. Why? Because economies cannot exist without it. That is the most important thing to understand. It's like saying that the English language is not valuable because it has no utility, but like my website and this podcast is super valuable. None of those things exist without a language. Your website doesn't communicate anything without a language. My podcast doesn't communicate anything without a language. Your payment network doesn't communicate value without something of value. And how do you have something without counterparty risk that holds value? You have something scarce that has no rug pull ability from anybody in the world, that has no counterparty risk, that has no master, that has no controller, where the rules are simply the rules and there's nothing anybody can do about it. That is an unbelievable problem, and nothing on this earth exists in that capacity. A system of rules where the rules are just the rules and nobody can cheat them. That is the value that Bitcoin brings. That is the value of sound money. That is why gold has been money for so long, because it's the one thing that was just so easy to verify. Okay, yeah, look at it. I got gold, and it's so incredibly difficult to fake it. All you have to do is weigh it 99% of the time, and you can know that it's basically real. Granted, the counterfeiting has gotten better with time, but that's why it worked for so long in that capacity. But it does nothing. It does none of that in the digital world. Money is a utility in and of itself. And it is the biggest utility of any economic network. Because the biggest problem of an economic network is coordinating production and communicating value. If you do not have money, you cannot do that. Your giant corporation that produces iPhones is completely worthless without a reliable monetary system to use.
And I'd say completely even if you could build a factory that made iPhones with no humans, you still got to pay for energy.
You have to pay for all of your input.
You ship the iPhone.
There's zero way to do this without a market economy. Zero way. And the better market economy will be the one that uses the sound money. And the sound money will be the one that has the highest integrity a system of rules and the highest assurances that you own it. And that's it.
And the lowest cost of ownership too, right? That's the other side, right? The house, I can live in it, whatever. Yeah, but as a homeowner, let me tell you, there's a significant cost of ownership in owning a house. And as a former landlord that never wants to be one again, there's a significant cost of ownership that goes with being a landlord, and not everything is in your favor. And, you know, somebody mentioned the value of real estate in the comments here. I said, real estate has value in America to its level. Like, everybody needs a place to live. That's valid. I'll give you that. But at its current level, where it's become like a de facto form of money, it only really has value because you can borrow against it. If you took away the ability to finance real estate with fiat debt against it, you would still have landlords. You would still have houses. That wouldn't all go away. But you would have nothing like you do right now. There wouldn't be guys talking about making money in your underwear, you know, by buying a house cheap and section 8ing it through the government or something. Like, none of that shit works unless you can borrow against the property, because people that make money in real estate do not make money with their own money. That's one of the reasons I say Dave Ramsey has terrible financial advice and decent get out of debt advice, right? Because his whole thing with real estate is, well, you only do real estate as a landlord unless you pay cash for it. Okay, that's how you go bankrupt, right? Like, people that make money in real estate, they buy lots of real estate with other people's money, and they don't care if half of it crashes. They don't give a fuck because they got the other half with a cash flow formula against it, and they're not paying shit for income tax on it because the whole thing's been rigged in that direction. But if you don't have a fiat system to go with fiat housing, which is what we have today, then it's worthless. Like, yep. One of the big problems we have with housing is they build all these fucking houses in a subdivision all at the same time, all out of cheap-ass freaking softwood now. There's no hardwood in construction anymore. It's all cheap-ass dimensional lumber. If you look, like, somebody posted a picture today of, like, they're building, like, a $400,000 new-built house, and they went in after the framers were done before they put up the drywall, and there's just shitty construction all through it. So they build this stuff. But when do they build this suburb, this whole subdivision? All within about 1 or 2 years, that whole subdivision's built. So when do all the houses start to fall apart? Within 1 to 2 years of each other. The whole fucking neighborhood starts falling apart at the same time. That's fiat. My dad lives in a house that was built in 1893. He hasn't done a fucking thing to it except put new carpet in and paint since the 80s. It's still there. I defy you to do that with anything built after 1965.
This is something that I talk about in my latest two sats video that I just posted on Twitter and Noster.
Is it the quadrant one?
No, not the give a shit matrix. It's the one I love it. is when should I sell my Bitcoin? Or when should I sell Bitcoin or whatever? One of the things that I try to point out is that, like, we think that the stock market and we think that real estate and housing goes up in value every year. And that's another thing, is like a whole bunch of people like Bitcoin can't possibly go up in value every year. That doesn't make any sense. It's like, dude, you literally think you believe this story already. You think that your house is just supposed to go up in price every single year and that does it indefinitely.
Yep.
It's literally only money that's supposed to do that because society grows and because money is sound, less of it buys more stuff just because we make more stuff. It is literally the mirror image of how much society grows is the price level of the money, of the hardest money in society. But regardless, you think that that's true of the stock market and real estate, but somehow it can't be true of the monetary system. Like, you've made a categorical mistake. What you're looking at are the two things that have simply replaced the monetary premium because our money sucks. But if you actually compare the S&P 500 over the last 80 years, or I think I did it on a 60-year chart, and the median home price and the M2 money supply, they are the exact same chart. All three of them on a logarithmic chart, perfectly in line with each other. Stock market dips below and then goes up above and it goes back, but it's all just fluctuating around the money supply growth. And then the same thing with housing, except interestingly, houses start to taper off at the end and they actually stay below the growth in the money supply. And that is actually how you know that it is in fact, because that's the thing that you feel, just like you pointed out. Your granddad's house or whatever built in 1890 is still standing, but you know the houses that you see built today won't even make it until their mortgage is up.
No, they won't.
That is the actual value of the house. Is how long is this thing going to last?
But the owner's going to have to be constantly rebuilding the house, right? Like that's the way that's going to have to happen. So this is what I've said about spending Bitcoin. Well, all these folks that want us to spend our Bitcoin, like, it's so important to them that, first of all, we don't have a spending shortage in America. We spend way more than we should. And becoming a Bitcoiner makes you more greedy with your spending because it's, technically it's not deflationary, but in reality it ends up being deflationary. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's going to be worth more tomorrow. So if you want me to go into my stack, you want me to plug in one of my hardware wallets and enter a code so I can actually send the Bitcoin out of that cold storage, you have to do something. You either have to give me something that I absolutely really, really need, or at least highly, highly desire that I don't have any other way to get it. Mm-hmm. Or you have to give me something that I look at that and it'll go and go, that will hold pace with the value of Bitcoin. So if you could sell me a house that was, it came with no property taxes, it had a self-healing roof, and I knew for a fact that my great-grandchild could live in that house and I don't have to do anything, I'll think about it. But if you're going to sell me a house that 15 years from now is going to need more money put into it and work to make it still a house than I'm going to pay for it today, mm-hmm. I'm not giving you Bitcoin for that. Yeah. In other words, if you want hard money, you have to give me a hard asset. You have to either give me an appreciating asset, or you have to give me at least, at bare minimum, a highly durable, serviceable asset that I'm going to use for a very long time, because if it's not that, then my money's more durable than your asset, and it's not a fair trade.
Yeah.
Right. Or you're going to have to sell me at a price that takes my appreciation into account. You want to sell me a house, what do you do right now? You send me the bank, and the bank says, okay, we'll loan you the money at 5%. Well, why don't you sell me the house for 95% of the, or 5% of the value, and I'll give you Bitcoin, and you'll do better in 30 years than if I pay 5% interest. We can talk that way too. But you're not getting my Bitcoin for some shit that I know is going to fall apart. I'm not giving you Bitcoin for a car.
That is the thing about sound money, is so many people will say Bitcoin's going to change our spending, and it's going to it's going to revalue the world, and we're going to understand, and we're going to have real interest rates and all of this stuff. Granted, a lot of people who say you should spend your Bitcoin, nobody's spending it in retail, they don't even understand that argument. They don't understand that that's actually
important. I'm still wondering where all these fuckers trying to buy a coffee and a scone with Bitcoin are. I've been hearing that right for 10 years. I haven't found anybody trying to do it yet.
But the thing is that they literally want Bitcoin to fix the money, and they want it to be sound money, and they want it to fix the multi-trillion dollar misallocation of resources and the bad spending habits. But then they want everybody to have the same spending habits.
Yeah.
Like they're literally demanding that everybody keeps spending it and just being, use it frivolously like they do fiat, and that it isn't successful if it doesn't do that. But then on the exact other hand, it's like, well, this will change this behavior. It's like, okay, well, what would it look like if it was changing the behavior? Maybe it was making people think twice about spending it on stupid, frivolous, cheap stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's the whole reason that it actually makes the change to begin with, is because it's going to go up in value, and suddenly you have to make the conscious decision to trade something that's going to be worth more next year for something that you know is just about to disappear. It's a croissant that you're about to eat. Do I need it? Do I really need it? Is this really the car I need? Do I need to spend this much money on it? Fiat literally incentivizes you to buy cheaper, crappier stuff that is more important in the short term. So it's out of line with the natural state of what financial decisions we would make. Whereas Bitcoin is actually on the other side, because it's being monetized. It's actually going to be more conservative than the natural state. This is Gresham's Law. Is this going to make you be even more frugal than anything that would naturally arise after we end up on a Bitcoin standard? We will get more likely to spend it and just use it day to day as it becomes more and more liquid, and all of its monetization premium gets basically priced out, and it falls to like a 15% every year growth in accordance with, or in reflection of, everything else. But other than that, it's doing exactly what it needs to do to fix that problem. And this is what it would look like.
It has to change the behavior prior to it being adopted into the new behavior model. You can't take hard money, shove it into a soft money model, and expect it to fix everything without altering the behavior. It's the person is saying, I want Ozempic. I don't want to eat a good diet. That's exactly – it's the same exact thing. Like the best thing – Musk just tweeted out like last week or whatever, X'd out, whatever the fuck it's called now, right? The best thing we could do for health in America is make Ozempic available to everybody. And I'm like, yeah, that is fiat thinking. Yeah. That is absolute fiat thinking. Like, instead of changing the behavior, we'll change the thing. Well, the thing will eventually stop working, right? My sister-in-law, I think, took one or two doses of Ozempic, and she's been wrecked for a year. She lost weight because she can't fucking eat anything now because it fucked up her digestive system. I guess it worked, technically, but that's not what we're looking for. We have to change the behavior first. And aren't these people... All these people, I will give them one thing, that are advocates of spending your Bitcoin. They're actually hardcore Bitcoiners, most of them anyway. They actually buy Bitcoin all the time. Every time you take dollars and convert it into Bitcoin, aren't you actually making the statement we're making? That if it was about spending, dollars spend easier, but yet you're buying Bitcoin with dollars. You're basically taking your money out of their casino and you're putting it into your own storehouse. And that's stating right there that you hold this thing in higher value than this other thing.
Yeah.
So if somebody wants Bitcoin, I'll give them Bitcoin. It's just not my Bitcoin. I'll spend dollars into Bitcoin, and I'll spend dollars. They receive Bitcoin. I don't have an accounting problem at all. And people are like, fuck the government. Don't pay taxes. I'm like, yeah, I hear you. I get what you're saying. And to be honest, if my neighbor gives me Bitcoin dollars or anything for a couple boxes of ammo I reloaded for him across the fence, I'm probably not putting that on my tax form. But I'm running a fucking business, and I'm not having everything I own destroyed by fucking around and finding out the hard way. Like, when I'm taking payments into my business and I'm paying expenses with those payments, there has to be a cash trail, right? And until we get over this shit, if I want to buy another house, I want to be able to go borrow fucking money. I have to show income to do that. There's a lot of things that you'll give up in society if you play it that way. When to me, people say, well, the taxes, I get the taxes, but let me tell you, my effective tax rate after my accountant got done with everything last fucking year was 12.5%. Because I understand something most people don't, and that is the tax code is like two 1980s phone books, but 90% of it is how you get out of doing what 10% of it says you have to do. So yeah. I'd rather focus on doing it completely legally, even if I think it's immoral, because it benefits me. And that's really what we're talking about here. It can all be summed up in one thing, incentives. Humans work on incentives. And when you understand the incentives, then you play the game better than people who do not.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love that Carl brought up the whole time thing. Is like that really is the major thing for understanding or for relating the value of Bitcoin. Like all of the times that I have quote unquote cashed out, I've used my Bitcoin for life. It has always been on something that I just realized that in 10 years. Like let's say whatever the Bitcoin I had was going to be worth $50 million. And then if I spent this, it was only going to be $40 million or something, something ridiculous, right? Is your 20 years or whatever the timeline is, right? Is that okay? Well, in that time, if right now my choice is to start a family, is to get a house for us to settle down, to have like a sense of stability in our life. And then not having that, but then having $20 million extra dollars in 20 years. I don't really care. Like, what is $20 million extra dollars at that time when I've taken the best years of my life to build a family and to do these things or to make an investment in a project that I really, really hope, like the Pear Drive project or whatever. That was another one that I just did that math on. I was like,
yeah,
okay, like this is the time to actually do this. If I want to feel like I've actually put a piece of my attempt to make things better on the board, then I do it now. I don't do it in 7 years, you know, and what's the cost? If it costs me this X amount, if it costs me one Bitcoin today to do this, and then in 5 years, it's $1 million, am I okay with losing that? And it's all about long-term timeframes. It's all about the time lost that ends up becoming the most valuable comparison to understanding when you want to use Bitcoin. But ultimately, at the end of the day, Bitcoin is my money. Time is my measurement for whether or not I should use it. Lifetime measure, like lifetime framing for when and how I should use it. And the dollar is nothing but my payment network. It's just the easiest way to make use of my Bitcoin. And I don't hold that crap in a payment network for any length of time at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Time is the ultimate thing that should be your metric for whether or not it is worth that trade-off.
There's another way to look at that too, right? So if we look at that time value and say, what is deferring pleasure of buying shit right now by taking, let's say, a month's salary from a person making about 40 grand a year, that's about 3,200 a month. It's a little more because I'm an accounting nerd, so there's 4.34 weeks in a month. It's not four, but just to say it's 3,200 bucks, right? So out of a year, if you took 1 month's salary and put it into an asset that over the next 4 years would appreciate at least 10x, which Bitcoin blows that right the fuck out of the water, right? Okay. Now that means that $3,200 would be worth $32,000. How many more hours would you have had to work to make that 32 grand if you had just done it through the use of your labor? And the answer is you would have had to work about 80% of a year more over that 4 year period. You would have had to work an extra freaking, 8.5 months. So now you have that time because you already put in the energy, you already put in the time, and the value wasn't eroded over time. Instead, it was increased over time.
Yeah.
And this is, people try to, when you tell people this stuff, they'll say, well, what's the difference in buying Apple stock then or whatever? Well, there's a huge difference because Apple stock does not come without third-party risk. I can't decide I want something really, really nice that guy has and say, fuck it, here's my Apple stock. I can't transfer it. I can't leave the country and take my Apple stock with me without filling out a lot of fucking paperwork. I can't self-custody my Apple stock. You know, I can't give my son a 12-word phrase that after I'm dead, he has my Apple stock without having to go through probate, right? Like, there's so
and
many...
And it's explicit counterparty risk.
Yes.
You're just saying that you should trust this counterparty. The value of a good money is the lack of a counterparty. It doesn't matter what Apple does. It doesn't matter what any of these other, what level of, like, Apple could make a terrible decision or,
Steve Jobs could die
and then the stock plummets, these sorts of things. Like, it has massive counterparty risk that a sound money simply doesn't have over long stretches of time. And right now, the only reason it's so volatile right now is because people don't get it. It's because it's not got any of the foundation. It's not got the mental hold. And monetary transitions usually take 50 to 100 years. I think this one will happen in 30 to 40 because we have the internet,
Yeah.
All of the historical examples we have.
If you compare it to the internet, it still puts us in about 1993, 94. Where the simpletons on the morning show were trying to figure out what the at symbol in an email was. That's how early this is. And I don't think people really get that.
Well, it really took 40 years for the internet to become what the internet is. Like, we were still huge, massively in the mix of, like, it wasn't until the early 2000s that it really started to take off and started to infiltrate things. Yeah. And you had Amazon and you had Facebook and you had like all of these things started to come up, and it really changed how people interacted with each other and the layers of communication. But even today, we're just reaching the point where media online and podcasts and Joe Rogan and Twitter are the new media, and the old media is literally just basically nails in the coffin at this point. It's been 45 years. Like, and you think like Bitcoin's just supposed to do this in two? Like,
I remember in 1980s, me and all my buds, we all had Commodore 64s. And there was the whole military government version of the internet, but we had like our proto internet where we had these freaking cradles, and you picked up a phone, you had to have a list of phone numbers, and you dialed one other computer. And you got the handshake telling you put it in the cradle, and then you had a board that was like a giant chat stream, right? And like you'd call this one that you knew the other people hung out on, and it was like Telegram. Like, you had to it was worse because there weren't even hashtags or anything. You had to scroll through mounds of shit to find the last person you were talking to.
What are you talking about?
It worked, right? And that's how far we've come since when I was a teenager in high school.
Yeah.
Today, you guys are watching me and Guy live on something called YouTube that nobody even thought would work when they built it. That fucking Google only – you know why Google bought YouTube? They had too much cash. They had so much cash on hand that the SEC was talking about converting Google stock into a mutual fund because they were not putting enough of their capital to work. So they're like, fuck, what can we buy? So they bought YouTube, and it turned into what it turned into after they bought it. Like, this is this type of progression. And if you told somebody, because I did as a marketing consultant back in the early 2000s, you need a YouTube channel. What they said was it's sophomoric and it's for kids. And by what, 2004, every presidential candidate had a YouTube channel. Right? Certainly by 2008. Certainly by 2008.
Dude, I know that was that. Like, that's another one of the things is that they talked about, like, YouTube being like such, like, we're professionals. We're the ones that own film and production. YouTube is not a threat to us. There's just like 15-second videos of nobodies and 100,000 people watch it. Well, that's stupid. That's not sophisticated. That's not real production. And they failed to recognize that there's been zero market between like big million-dollar production that actually has the contractual deals to go on a broadcast channel and be blasted out nationally. And you now have it. You have a situation where the dynamic has changed so much that somebody with a 15-second video of just like getting hit in the face with a dodgeball can get 100,000, a million views on YouTube in a matter of weeks. Like, if you just like take a moment and you you recognize what the shift in the market and the access to the audience is, you know that that is your death. You know that that's the end of it, because now there's going to be 5-7 layers of degrees of film, type of media, type of tutorials and 2-hour long podcasts and everything that is going to eat into the attention that you have a monopoly on. And you're gonna miss it completely because you think people care about the production quality. No, yeah. They care about connection and they care about being entertained. And at the end of the day, they're gonna have more production quality when all is said and done, because they're gonna gut you of your audience and you're not gonna have any capital left to actually make it the way you wanted to make it. Like, it just.
Correct. And they're outpaying these people to advertise for them today. They're out making deals with influencers that are dumbass kids. The reality, though, is if you want to understand the world, you're better off listening to content like this, and not just us. Listen to everybody, including the people that we say are idiots, right? Because when you do that, it's like being in a room, and that room has 100 windows. And what the media is telling you is we have these 3 windows for you to look out of, and they're all on the same wall. And trust us what's out there. And even if they're telling you accurately what's outside those windows, there's another freaking 97 windows that you could be looking out of. And that's why, like, we think people are stupid. But if you look at a game like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, when they ask the audience is almost, not always, but almost always right in the majority. Because when you get collective intelligence from different vantage points, you tend to get a clearer view of the problem you're trying to solve. So this is why they hate it. I mean, I don't know about you, but when Trump got shot in the ear, I knew more in 2 hours on X than the media seemed to know 2 weeks later. Like, we had pictures of the ladder. We had, like, guys saying they saw, like, the crowdsourcing, or that dude that just popped the healthcare CEO in New York City, and they the police discovered that he used this electric bike. No, some random fucking dude on X posted that shit, figured it out himself from publicly available information long before the cops knew anything about it. So we have that many different signal points coming in. That gives you a better picture, right? It's just like a digital camera. Like, the higher the megapixels, the clearer the image.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that ever going backwards now. And I think that's why we're in a defendable position with what we're doing, because there's too many of us. If it's just me or you, squish, right? Miyagi, squish like grape, right? Mm-hmm. But when you have thousands and thousands of people mining, node running, disseminating information, even if some of them are wrong, the picture that the person that actually consumes all of that information and thinks for themselves gets is a clearer picture, even if it's not 100% accurate. It's still better.
Yeah, it's ultimately the what's the quote? It's the don't try to defeat them within their game. Create a new game.
Create a new game.
Change the nature of the fight altogether. Is that, like, new technology changes the landscape. You can change it's like a change in the football field or a change in the rules of football. Rather than trying to play it within their rules and then, you know, every time the referee just issues 20 points to the other team, just be like, well, I'm gonna touch down harder this time.
Yeah.
And you're playing a fundamentally broken game. So get on a field in which the refs can't change the points. You know, like, the technology itself fundamentally changes the landscape of what is between you and your audience, what is between you and the person you want to receive money. And Bitcoin has so deeply and fundamentally changed that. And everybody's just lost in the weeds. They're lost in the, oh, what about the app? It's not as good as WhatsApp. And they fundamentally miss the fact that the foundation has shifted. It has shifted massively. And even the level of things that we can argue about and we can be completely ungrateful about having fixed, like, basically we're already spoiled. And the level of thing that we argue about is that we should have total and complete, utter, unbreakable privacy, and we should have total and utter sovereignty over all of our money in the digital space, and we should be able to spend it censorship resistant. Like, that has become the standard because of what a staggering leap Bitcoin is. The idea of suggesting that back in 2008, you'd have been laughed at. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
None of this exists. None of this exists. You're literally talking about okay, I want a teleporter, you dummy. You know, but 2009, suddenly that is the context of the conversation. It is the thing that you can actually hope and expect to have at some point in the future. It's just something we still got to build.
So now I'm going to ask you the question everybody in the Bitcoin space that's legit like you are hates being asked. What do you think the cycle high is this time? He just pushed his glitch button.
Somewhere between 200 and 500,000.
That's kind of where I am. That's kind of where I think I posted 214 to 250 about a couple weeks ago, and somebody said that won't work this time. Okay.
In my Goku Super Saiyan meme that I did, I put it in the next time on Dragon Ball Z, the thing in the outro of the meme.
Yeah.
I had 271,700 something on his like Super Saiyan thing, so that was like the price. So that'll be my unofficial prediction for where it tops.
I said, did I just call the top of the market at whatever it was?
That was you.
And he was like getting stronger, and everybody else, it was like anime, and everybody else was getting, okay, I remember that now, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe
if it ends up there, that would be glorious because it was totally right. I just threw a number in there. I think people will think it's over, you know, at 140, 150, and there will probably be like a 40% dump. Like there will be a significant crash and people will be like, this shit is over. It'll basically just punch everybody in the nuts who is convinced that it's done and it will not be done. Bitcoin takes the path of greatest pain every single time. Your expectation is going to make you lose money if you start like betting on that, especially if you're thinking about the short term.
Right? Everybody that thinks they can outsmart the timing ends up hurt, and including very smart people. And I think the worst thing that can happen is you can pull it off a couple trades. And then you think you're better than you are, and you think you've got it figured out. And the next thing you know, you're watching a God candle while you're out. I think DCA
over
is
a weekend thing. While markets are closed. And
What do you think about Garrett's question here? He said, would you recommend selling Bitcoin for a home purchase, first time home buyer, modest home, down payment only, and finance the balance? That sounds like somebody just, they want a house and they don't have the down payment. I can't tell somebody what to do with their money, but I would say if you have $500,000 worth of Bitcoin and you need $20,000 for a down payment, that's a very different question. If you have $20,000 in Bitcoin and you need $20,000 for a down payment, I think that it's a function of what are we talking about as a percentage of your holdings and how valuable is it to you to have a house? And then there are people.
What's the trade-off? Like renting for some span of time before, you know, we get through another cycle top or something. I would say I did sell some back in 2017 to put a down payment on the house, but I did everything in my power to put as little as I could down. I did a FHA assistance, and I also bought a crappy house. Okay. I bought a house that required a lot of fixing up, and I mean, we've made it way more valuable today, but you have to remember that if you buy the house, that the dollar is going to be printed, you're going to get free equity in the house over time because of the inflation rate, the amount of money getting did. So I would compare that to what equity you're going to build in the house, which might be 5%, 7%, 10% a year tops, to what Bitcoin's typical CAGR is, which is like what's the return per year. I think right now it's like 150% like per year over if you put it out over long spans, which I think is probably more realistically like 60% if you kind of like take out some of the early zones and like the peak periods.
Yeah.
So if your interest rate is less than 60%, probably just makes sense to hold the Bitcoin. then take the debt, basically. And it's also not impossible, especially right now when we're heavily in a bull market.
Yeah.
To loan against, to get a loan, a collateralized loan against your Bitcoin. But don't do it to a point where if Bitcoin drops 40%, you get called out and you lose all your Bitcoin. Don't do that. Do something that you can manage. So like if you need $20,000 in down payment and you have $100,000 in Bitcoin, well, then you can do that. Take out a loan at, you know, 12% or whatever. Yeah. And then you're super unlikely to get like just demolished. Cause it is, that is a leverage trade. It's just like very thin. It's just like deep, you know, it's not like a crazy future 100x futures contract or something. So that is something to be careful about, but in this environment, it might be the way to go. I've done that throughout the previous bear markets and it's worked out really great in my favor. It would have cost me, I think 5x the amount of Bitcoin as it costs right now to get rid of all of that debt. Which it's not much, it's like two loans. It definitely worked heavily in my favor. And you know, after, you know, if it doubles or something and, you know, it costs you 20,000 and that was going to be 0.2 Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin goes to 240,000. Now it costs you 0.08 Bitcoin or something like that. Well then, okay, we'll just close it out and then you can pull it in the, equity of the house or whatnot, and then you get another bear market. Well, then great opportunity to take equity out of the house and buy some more Bitcoin again.
And I think those strategies
definitely value the Bitcoin as the foundation.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll say, like, if you're talking about buying houses, then the first thing you need to do is learn how to actually buy a house, which, you notice they don't teach that in school, like what to look for, how to buy a house, right? So the best way to learn how to buy a thing is first learn how to sell it. If you learn how to sell a thing effectively, then you learn how to buy effectively. So I have a method of selling your house that's worked dramatically well for my audience for a long time. It's called the 1% effect. And all we do is we look at all the comparable homes in our price range, in our general area where somebody would be looking. Most buyers are shopping a zip code or two at most, right? So we want to know what's available, and we don't want to just look at the price. We want to look at the condition of the house in the range. And we sit with this concept. All buyers are settlers. Everybody settles for less than they want. I don't care if you're buying a $5 million fucking house in Malibu, you still would have preferred to have the $7 million house that you can't afford. So everybody's settling. And that's the key to triggering the buy. So we look at the market and we make our house show 1% better than everything else in the price range. And we will sell that fucking house. And I mean in days. I've sold every house. I've sold them in good markets, bad markets, shitty markets. I've made money on every house. I've sold above my asking price over 20 years, 6 times I've sold houses with that formula. So now we reverse engineer that. You want the house that doesn't have like a foundation falling apart. It doesn't have the Beverly Hillbillies living next door, you know, or something like that. It's not like a complete deal breaker. It shows 1% less than the median. That house will sit there for days and days and days, except in the hottest markets, and eventually that seller will capitulate. And I'll give you an example of how the buy side works. Here's my house, and I did buy it in 2013. 2,500 square feet, 5 bedrooms, 3 acres, a 1,500 square foot metal shop, a 800 square foot metal shop, fenced and cross-fenced with chain link. I paid $200,000 for my house. Because it showed like dog shit, but nothing was actually hard to fix. You're looking for the lazy seller that won't do the little things. Like there was peel and stick parquet flooring throughout the house. Easy fix, cost some money, certainly didn't cost as much money as the differential in the value of the house. And by the way, they listed it for $265. And I eventually got it for $200, right? Because it's that exact, like as soon as I saw it, I'm like, I can do anything I want here. And these fuckers won't fix this easy shit. That's the house you want to buy. And if you learn to buy that house and then you do what you said, you can use leverage way more effectively if you need to. But I'd be very – make sure it's not an emotional decision. There's so many people – you know, the millennial and Gen Z like catchphrase is now what? I'll never own a house. Make sure that's not baiting you into doing something before you're ready. I think – and I don't care if you use Bitcoin or not. I think that can be a very bad thing is – the idea that as long as I buy the house, somebody else will pay more for it later. That shit doesn't always work out either, does it, guy?
Yeah. Doesn't always. No.
Yeah. So one of my best friends, I knew he was in deep shit because he paid like $300+ for something in Connecticut back in like, I want to say around 2011 or something like that. And then he said, but somebody will always pay more for it in the future. And I'm like, man, and I didn't say it because I don't ever want to say something like this to somebody I like. But I was thinking, you're one divorce away from finding out how fucked up that belief was. And it was 2 years later, he got served with divorce by his wife. And no. It was right in the middle of like a down market too. And they took like $100,000 bath on the place, you know, because she wasn't going to listen to reason. They had to sell it. So they both ended up with debt instead of money.
Yeah.
It's just be careful when you buy shit, guys. Always.
It's almost like if they had consensus, it would have been better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Too bad we don't have consensus protocols. You can't like to not realize the staggering value of that, of like something that persists in the spite of disagreement, when you can't even get people who love each other and trying to spend their lives together to agree on stuff like this.
Agree on stuff.
Most vicious battles like that. Yeah. It cannot understate how valuable that is, that the rules are the same no matter who disagrees with it.
And like kind of macro generic
otherworldly. Yeah.
Yeah. My macro generic Uncle Jack advice in this is spend every penny like it's Bitcoin because it could be.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the problems we have is people are too quick to part with their money. I don't know about you. I've got a lot stingier over the last 10 years. I've gotten more wealthy and stingier. And I don't mean I won't help people. I don't mean I'm greedy. I mean that buying shit for myself is where I'm stingy. Like, oh, I don't need that. Oh, I don't need that. Oh, I don't need that. Like, I always say, like, well, if I didn't buy this thing and I bought Bitcoin, how much Bitcoin would that be?
Yeah.
So even when it's dollars I can spend, well, I can spend it on Bitcoin or I can spend it on another gadget. And what do I really need and want? And what am I willing to give up to have more later? And I think the time preference thing is huge. Here's a question for you.
I'm going to be running out of time here. Do you want to lightning round through these?
Yeah.
Super chats?
Let's do that quick, right? If Trump were to be able to executive order a strategic reserve day one, which he said he's going to do, would that change your price prediction? If Trump really does announce the United States is creating a strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Over the short term, yes. Like for this cycle, yeah, probably.
Okay.
That would be a huge deal. But I also think we're in the cycle in which governments are talking about strategic reserves one way or the other.
Yeah.
But certainly short, like in the short run, decisions and which country and whatnot and you know what companies put it on their balance sheet will make a big difference. But I think we're going to have a hell of a run because countries are going to decide to do that at this era. Yeah. I think
when you have like the most powerful economic power in the world, though, if they do it, it's going to make a lot of other people feel like they have to.
I
think any G7,
it would be ridiculous. Yeah.
I almost feel like any G7 would have a major impact. Mm-hmm. Maybe the U.S. would have the most, but one G7 nation doing it, I think you're going to see a lot of piling in. Real quick, Anarchy, not a question, just says thanks in advance and threw us $7.77. So thanks for that. GM guy, do you think there will be another vicious bear market or more like super cyclish? So do we get
two things on that? Yeah, two things on that is one is it's really easy. I've thought so many times through multiple like cycles in the past that like this was it.
Yeah.
People are really, really hard to change how they think. I don't think super cycle. I think we're in the super cycle, and the vicious bear market are just what happens in the super cycle. It's just a time frame thing.
Like
the super cycle is 50 years. So yes, there will be vicious bear market. I also hope, I really hope there will be vicious bear markets, and it's not because. I mean, yeah, cheap sats are great, and I want another thing to stack or whatever, and it very much changes people's mentality and how they think about volatility and what things should be in the economy rather than having a natural economy actually exist and then, you know, operating within it. But it also is exactly what's needed to wipe out the horrible, irresponsible behaviors of the fiat world. is they are going to leverage themselves. They are going to fractional reserve Bitcoin. They will. But the yeah. bear market will kill them. It will yeah. kill them. If they continue to do what they have done in the fiat world, they will get their asses handed to them. We will end up probably this cycle with some major bank that is holding 100,000 Bitcoin and they've got 200,000 worth of Bitcoin tokens yeah. out there that people are using. And somebody is going to withdraw, Michael Saylor is going to withdraw, try to withdraw 110 and it's going to call their bluff and they are going to collapse. And that is what I think will end this, probably this cycle is okay. the collapse of a major fiat name, a JP okay. Morgan, a Citigroup.
Like somebody saying they have something they don't.
It will be someone from the legacy system that makes yeah. a massive investment in Bitcoin and thinks that they can do the same, pull the same bullshit
okay, I got you.
For the last 50 years, because this is just how you do business.
So you're not saying it'll be Saylor's custodian. It'll be somebody bullshitting
and somebody
outside.
With a lot of Bitcoin in that thing will yeah. withdraw and they will realize that they can't play the same fake like paper game that they can in fiat, and they will be Bitcoin will be the demise. That'll be my prediction for this cycle. Bitcoin will be the demise of a massive bank.
And then they'll say Bitcoin failed and it died again.
Yep.
And it won't.
Yep. And it was a Ponzi. Look, the bank invested in it.
The fact that it's an anti-Ponzi
was the Ponzi.
Yes.
And Bitcoin exposed it, you dumb. But whatever.
Have you ever noticed nobody would like you get a Ponzi, like a big investment Ponzi? What's his name? The guy back in the early 2000s that they burnt Madoff. They never blamed the dollar for the Ponzi. They blame the Ponzi until it's Bitcoin. Then it's Bitcoin's the Ponzi.
Yeah.
I've heard that one too. Like Bitcoin holds its
Ponzi
value.
Ponzi literally don't survive in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
We've watched
you
it.
Can't.
Mt. Gox, FTX, Terra Luna. Like they do not reinflate. Bitcoin is the Ponzi killer.
Every supposed failure of Bitcoin was actually a success of Bitcoin exposing the Ponzi, right?
Exactly.
Bitcoin lifts the veil that the magician is trying to hide with the pretty girl with the big tits in front of you. That's what it is. Why are people I watch on YouTube saying Bitcoin's been up for 7 weeks in a row? Coinbase says different. I don't know.
If you got to advertise something on YouTube, it's probably just some crypto shill or some trader bullshit, especially if they're telling you what Bitcoin did in the last 7 weeks as if it's some declarative. I don't know. Everything just moves up and down. It's crazy. I mean, it's been quote unquote up for the last 7 weeks. It's higher than it was 7 weeks ago, but it certainly didn't get in a straight line.
No, it always goes up and down, but I don't think that's really, I mean,
it's irrelevant. You're just listening.
What day are you starting your weekend? Monday or Sunday might even change that.
In the end,
you know, it looks pretty good over the last 3 months. So I'll just, and that's 90 days. So whatever. Moving on. Was Bitcoin supposed to be a payment system from its origin? You know, I would say the
major problem with that question is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Is what does supposed to be mean? According to who? Like you're saying that someone's narrative about Bitcoin trumps or suggesting that maybe the narrative around Bitcoin or what I think Bitcoin should be trumps what Bitcoin actually is.
Yeah.
Is it a global decentralized payment system that anybody can use for retail and it scales to 8 billion people? No, it is not at all. It never was. The very first response to Satoshi in releasing the white paper was, this is cool, but it doesn't scale. So no, it is not and was not from its origin the payment system that a lot of people say it was. It seemed like it when you still only had 10,000 people or 100,000 people using it, because it specifically works and looks like one when it doesn't have to scale. When it's really small, it does appear and work a lot like one, but it doesn't survive that, and it does not survive the characteristics or any of the elements that make it decentralized when you scale that up to 100 million and a billion people. This is the problem of all networks since always, is how do you scale across the cultural cohesion and the social cohesion layer.
And every form of money, good or bad, has always had systems developed for it. The money itself wasn't the system. So you could build a payment system that integrates Bitcoin. And I also kind of look at this as like, Volvo is one of the smartest companies in the world, at least they were, because they were willing to let the market tell them what they were. So when Volvo was initially really marketing the shit out of themselves about 40 years ago. They wanted to be cool. And a Volvo was anything but cool. But the market decided when they looked at crash data, it was the safest car you could put your kid in. And Volvo got handed the brand of safety. Mm-hmm. Somebody in that company was smart enough to go, shut the fuck up. If that's what the market says and they're the ones with the money, then that's what we are. The market will mm-hmm. always define the utility in the end, no matter what the creator thought they were making. How many things in your home do you have and you use and you like that they weren't quite what the vision of the creator had for it when it was created? Like, if you look at things like a television set today, like, it doesn't do what the first person said a television set was supposed to do.
The Lumiere brothers created the cinematograph, the first film camera, and they thought it was a gimmick.
Yeah.
They invented it, but they never thought, like, you know, it ended up being in Nickelodeons, which were the things that you look in and, like, for 5 seconds you could put a nickel in it and it would show you a moving image, and that was, like, the cool thing. And the Lumiere brothers did, like, the train in the theater room or whatnot, but they didn't think to sell stories with it.
No.
Like, it would be, like, this massive media enterprise or whatnot. They just built it because they thought it was cool looking.
Or Kodak had the first digital camera in the 70s and didn't think anybody would want it.
Yeah.
Now every single person with a camera phone has a digital camera 100 times better than it, and it's probably used more than the phone part of the phone, right? I mean,
and I will say Satoshi absolutely was trying to build that. The cypherpunks have been trying to build that forever, like for like 30 years, like the entire history of like that culture and that thinking. And importantly, Satoshi solved the handful of core problems that will enable us to build that. And in his effort to build it, he solved a problem that is foundational to the ability to have a global, decentralized, trustless payment system that everybody
can use. To have that system, you must first have a money to go in it.
But he just built the money. First building block.
Yeah.
He built the first building block, and now it's like inventing a new type of steel and saying, like, oh, it's going to be a bridge, but we still don't know how to engineer bridges.
Yeah.
Like, with this new steel, we still have to build the bridge.
But you need the steel first.
But you got to have the steel.
Exactly. You got to have the steel. You got to have the better steel. What's the best way to invest Bitcoins in ETFs? If your money is stranded somewhere, you can't buy it directly. That's the best.
Stuck in an IRA or, you know, a 401k that your business, your employer is matching or something like that. That's when you do an ETF. If you can do self-custody, then just do buy that. Bitcoin.
I agree.
You got risk and you got fees and stuff with ETFs. But
I'm of the belief that surplus capital goes into Bitcoin and stranded surplus capital goes into a Bitcoin ETF. That's the way I would put it. It has to be stranded or there's no purpose unless if you're a high frequency trader, which you wouldn't be listening to us if you were. You'd be busy doing your high frequency trading. You could save a lot of money in fees using ETFs as your trading mechanism. But I don't do that because I'm one of those people that I made a lot of really good trades and I made a lot of money. And then I thought I was good. And then I was just like my old mentor, who was a North Carolina redneck with a Harvard MBA. That is a dangerous man. Used to tell me, Jack, even a turkey can fly in a tornado. if you go into trading right at the beginning of a bull market, you can't fuck it up as long as you're patient. But sooner or later, the bull turns into a bear, and then do you have the staying power to wait for it to come back? And sure you do if you bought it for money you had and you didn't need, but if you leverage your way into it, and at least I never did that, then you're fucked, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's – is it stranded capital otherwise that you would want to invest in Bitcoin? And a lot of the Roth 401s now have a brokerage option inside them. So even if they said, here's your 10 funds or whatever, you can still go outside of that fold and – do that, please. Benyo, the last one we got for you, guy, is
Reardon Metal. I agree, Carl. It's Reardon Metal. Sorry.
Do you think that this will be the last cycle where alts and shitcoins have significant market share? If Bitcoin market cap reaches 5+ trillion, well, that's way off. Will altcoins and stablecoins keep up?
They will continue, altcoins specifically. They will continue to not keep up. There will probably be short periods where they do outpace just because it's less liquid. So not unexpected. But I really just kind of think the trend of the last two cycles will play out again. The last cycle was not exaggerated in crypto as it was in 2017.
Yeah.
And then I think this cycle will not be as exaggerated as the 2020 to 21 period. And it will just keep diminishing returns. But I think there will be an alt market every single time for a long time to come. And specifically, I think stablecoins will actually be huge, because I think stablecoins will threaten the actual payment system and banking infrastructure. So stablecoins could very well, like a dollar stablecoin could very well outpace Bitcoin, because that's about a technological infrastructure change, not a monetary change. And we could see a lot of banks go to that. That's like, rather than changing the dollar market itself, what's a good analogy? It's just like, imagine all the banks went to, you know, they used to do cash, debit, yeah, and all of this stuff, and then they went to credit cards and, yeah, and electronic cards. I think stablecoins is a mirror to that sort of thing. It doesn't change the monetary infrastructure and the monetary rules or who's the master or anything like that, but it does change how payments are made and how you own it and all of those things. So I actually think stablecoins will be huge, because they're more like the old media going to the internet. You know, it's them opening up their streaming service, but they're still the same.
You say outpace Bitcoin, you mean in adoption and use, not in value, because obviously they're not going to go up in value.
In value, the fiat is just the value.
Yeah.
So dollar is already way bigger than Bitcoin. Yeah. I'm saying the amount of share of stable coins,
yeah,
because the dollar is bigger, it could be the stable coins themselves of the dollar could be bigger than Bitcoin
in market cap, for instance, and transaction usage, but not in unit value. Yeah, I would agree.
The unit value is just the dollar. If it's not the dollar, it's worthless, you know.
And that's why, you know, we'll wrap up here, and I'll kind of, John is asking, would Litecoin serve as the day-to-day purpose of transacting? Well, Bitcoin serves as a store of value. Basically, Litecoin serving the role as currency. And I don't think so, because in short-term transactions in this phase where we have volatility, and Litecoin tracks Bitcoin fairly well, it's just faster and cheaper. I don't see that being the hindrance of adoption for payments being... It's one of them, but it's not as much as all the other shit, right? So just because it's faster and cheaper doesn't matter. What a person that's going to spend money at the end of the month wants to know is, I have $800 at the first of the month. At the end of this month, I have to pay my rent. I don't want that $800 to be $750 at the end of the month. If I'm holding it long term, I do not give a fuck. But if I need to spend it, then I need that stability. And that's why people get really mad at me. I don't call stablecoin shit coins any more than I would call the dollar a shit coin, right? Like, yeah. Yes, but not.
Which you might call it a shit coin.
But not the way you mean it. What they mean is it goes in the same place that something like freaking Solana or something goes. And no, because it actually serves a function for that person that says, I want to be digital. I want this self-custody thing, but I want some portion of my money in some form that I know I can pay my bills through this month with.
Yeah. And I would say with the Litecoin analogy, there's two things to consider. Is one, it's not actually for what you're getting out of Bitcoin and what you're getting out of these networks. It's actually not cheaper and it's not faster.
Okay.
Because it takes almost a day it takes a much, much longer time to actually get the number of confirmations that are equal to the security of a single confirmation on Bitcoin. So the amount of security that you get in it, just because its confirmations are faster, it's like, well, how does that confirmation relate to the amount of security you get on Bitcoin? So it actually isn't cheaper and faster. It just appears that way because it's diluted.
Okay.
You know, it's like saying that a grocery cart is cheaper and faster than a tank. It's like, well, what are you trying to get out of it?
What are you trying to do with it?
What are you trying to do with it?
Move groceries from store to your car, sure. Invade a country, you need a tank.
Yeah. The second one, though, the second major consideration is, what do you want out of a payment system? Like, what do you want out of something that you're going to use for payments? Well, you want massive liquidity. You want massive adoption. Yep. You want acceptance. and you want something where all of the infrastructure is already in place, because you're not going to pay 10 times the infrastructure to invest in something that people don't want and is not as much invested in. So basically, Bitcoin is more likely to be the payment mechanism and medium of exchange than Litecoin, because Bitcoin has higher liquidity and is more valuable, which means that the payment system, the day-to-day payment system that people will use while Bitcoin remains a store of value during this era, is just obviously the dollar. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody would use Litecoin over the dollar. That doesn't make any sense. The dollar already has all of the liquidity. It already has the payments. And if stable coins are being expanded at the same time, well, then you're going to have whole countries and whole populations that have had no access to the dollar now actually have access to the dollar. See, so we will have a two-money system. This will be Bitcoin the money and dollar the payment network.
I've been saying this, that they actually want this to happen because they have an inflation problem, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they need, for their system to work, they need inflation, but they've had too much. And so they need some kind of a reset. And they're at an end game state unless you can pull something else off. Because if you try to rebase the dollar again, you've already gone this fraction, 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 fraction. Now you get fraction of nothing. Right. So there's not really a lot of places to go from here. You can only fuck around with interest rates so much and what have you. And it's only so much contracting of the monetary supply you can do in the current state. But what if you could shove the dollar into every major economy in the world more than it is right now? Well, the way you do that is if you make stable coins accepted, if you were to go as far as to say, listen, guy, you're the president of Bank of America or whatever, if you guys want your own stable coin, that's fine. It just has to fall under FDIC. Well, now the person in Angola can hold dollars secured by FDIC on a phone. And now you push and you dilute the impact of inflation by pushing more dollars out into the world than exist right now. And I don't know if there's a practical way to do that, but I bet those fuckers are going to come up with some way to basically say a stable coin, or I like one of the guys here said, I'd rather they call it a dollar coin. Because they're not stable. Yeah. They're stable relative to the dollar, right? A dollar coin is...
And stable coin is really just kind of a dumb name.
It is.
Honestly, it's like it's...
Because it's not stable if you're a European.
Yeah.
Unless you have a Euro one, right? In your...
I think a better branding and more accurate, even though I hate the word crypto now, is a crypto dollar.
Okay.
Rather than a paper dollar and a bank dollar, you have a crypto dollar, you know.
Like, crypto dollar.
But dollar coins just as good, you know. Like,
and then you can self-custody dollars anywhere in the world in a way that's way more secure than putting it in your pocket. There's a lot of places in the world, if you have physical dollars on you, you're in danger.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a lot of danger, you know. Like, you know, there's places where a $100 bill is, you know, a month and a half salary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not... kind of thing you want to walk around with, but if you could break it up in little bits and parts and have it hidden in different nooks and nannies inside a device, that's a whole different world. And I think that's a good place to end. I think that's where we're headed. We're heading to a place, Bitcoin's money, dollar is currency, and everything's digital.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of maxis that will really hate me for saying that. Bro, I forecast weather, I don't make it. I mean, that's, you know, there are people that get mad because at the weatherman because it rained on Saturday. He didn't make it rain. He just told you it was going to. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, what we should have. Yeah, that's fucking great. That's awesome. Like, if we had the world I think we should have, the world would be called Jackistan. Guy would be my vice king. And we would tell all of you what to fucking do. He'd be my vice king. I don't want to be president of the world. You can't get shit done when you're president.
I just want to be king. I got to get vice king to keep me in check.
Vice king, go for 5 years, fix everything, and then say, fuck off, it's yours now. If you fuck it up again, I really did step back from power. But
chance.
But that's the way, if I got what I want, and most people, if they got what they want, they would have, like, the wish should be the way I say it should be. Yeah, but it's not. And it's not going to be.
I actually want to answer Timothy.
Go ahead.
50,000 XRP or one Bitcoin. So I just looked it up real quick. So one Ripple coin, which is awful. I would never hold this for any length of time. But it's worth 40,700 XRP, which means that I could buy more than one Bitcoin with that amount of XRP. So if you want to send it to me, I will... The problem is that means, if I'm allowed to spend it, you give it to me, I do whatever the hell I want with it, it's going to become Bitcoin. So, if I want 1.2 Bitcoin, is 1.2 Bitcoin better or one Bitcoin better?
Yeah.
The problem is that 1.2 Bitcoin requires me to set up an exchange, set up with an exchange, and I have to swap it, and I hope that it doesn't dump in price. I have to hold it in the meantime. I have to install some software. So the question is all that annoyance worth 0.2 Bitcoin? Maybe. Depends on what I'm doing this afternoon.
Let's make it a little easier for you. It's in a smart contract. I'll give it to you, but it doesn't get released for 5 years.
Absolutely fucking not. Absolutely not. Not in a million.
You're taking the Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, I'm taking the Bitcoin. Yeah. Not even close.
Yeah.
I would not touch that.
If it's locked up and you can't do anything, you have to hold it.
You're going to give it to me for free. All right, whatever.
Because, I mean, we're obviously in hypotheticals here, because if somebody's going to give me anything, that's hypothetical. So we might as well, you know, make it a little bit more clear, because usually when somebody gives you something, it doesn't come without condition.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's your dad or something. Usually if somebody's going to do a thing for you, they want something in return.
Yeah.
If you told me 5 years, if you told me 2 years, I have to hold it. Because, man.
If I couldn't get rid of it today. For Bitcoin, no. Today. I'm not stretching this overnight. No, just give me a Bitcoin. I ain't got
I'll put it this way. I occasionally get somebody, I want to buy a membership from you, and I want to pay with Shitcoin XYZ. Hold on a second. I'll pull up a couple exchange accounts. Do they have it? Yes. Mm-hmm. I will generate an address on it. I don't move it to an exchange. It goes straight to that exchange. It goes straight to Bitcoin, and it goes straight to the stack. I mean, so, yeah. So technically, I will take a shitcoin, but I don't want to. And I don't – you know what? Back during the last big altcoin run – there were people wanted to pay. I haven't had a payment in a shitcoin. I think I had one for Litecoin a few weeks ago. At one this year. It's all Bitcoin. The other thing is, when I started, guy, I started in 08. That's how long I've been doing this crazy shit.
Yeah.
And I used to get a lot of payments, probably a good couple dozen a month, where people mailed me physical silver in the mail. I haven't seen that since
I think you told me about that. I think you told me about that.
I think 2017, 2018 is the last time I got a silver order in the mail. I've had people show up here and want to do it, and since they're here, they'll hand you a few ounces for a couple of years or something like that. But no, I have not had anybody pay with silver since before the block wars. It's been the last time somebody mailed me silver. And there was a problem with it, too. I had a lot of times, like, an envelope would show up, and some fucker in the post office figured out there was silver in there and stole it.
Oh, my God.
Now, since I'm not selling a physical product, and I care about
I wish you had a digital bearer asset that could just
get into final settlement, and, it'd be great. Anyway, man, hey, I appreciate you giving us 3 freaking hours today. Didn't think we'd go that long.
I feel like we actually got to catch up a bit this time.
Yeah.
Last time I felt rushed. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll let you go now. I know you're at like an in-laws or something, and you sequestered yourself in a bedroom or something to do this. So thank you for that. And we're kind of co-hosts today, but it really is kind of my audience that I've been the more interviewee type or interviewer, and you've been more interviewee. If you ever want to flip that around, just tell me. I'm always available to you.
All right, boss. Man, good hanging out, dude. Thank you for having me on. And my audience will hear it, too. They're not really on YouTube.
All right, man.
They're all on the feed. So.
Take care, everyone. We'll catch you guys tomorrow, TSP folks, anyway, with another episode.
Later, guys. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house. The American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.